morning. You're listening to the Senate Commission on Health Care Access and Affordability. Today's date is Friday, September 15th, 2006. We are holding our meeting today at the Oregon Dental Association headquarters in Wilsonville, Oregon. The time is 9 o'clock a.m., and our chair, as always, is Senator Alan Bates.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. We'll start with some housekeeping stuff. Rick, do you want to take that first?
Sure, real quickly. Couple things. The microphones pick up pretty good, but because they're still kind of spread out, please either turn it toward you or close to you, because if you have to pick it up on the tape machine, it's real important. It's a public meeting. Number two, when someone is talking, if you can avoid ruffling papers or doing anything near your microphone, because sometimes that will drown out the person speaking. So at least turn the mic in your direction when you're talking. We do have a working lunch today, so that'll be working around noon or so.
Thank you, Rick. A couple of quick announcements also is, Megan Sweeney's not here yet, right? Megan has taken a big promotion and is moving to Houston. This will be our last meeting, so I want a chance to say goodbye to her when she comes in, if she comes in there. And she's being replaced by Moon Crater. Okay. Nick Green will be taking your place, and I don't know if either of them are going to be here today. The other one is that probably the most important thing we're going to talk about today. I have a newspaper clipping here given to me by Jim Madison. Thank you, Jim. And it shows a very young Mitch Greenwick on it. And Mitch and Harriet are celebrating their, how many years of marriage?
50 years.
And just so we all have a light moment this morning, we'll pass this picture around. Congratulations. Is Harry here today?
No, she's not.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Mitch, is your safe home policy circles miles
I'm
going
to remind everybody, as I do at the beginning of each meeting, that we try to leave our hats and our turf at the door as much as we possibly can. As we discuss things here in the committee. We're going to start a second phase of the commission here today. We've talked for the last several months about what's wrong with the healthcare system. I think we all have a pretty good and pretty clear understanding of most of the issues involved. And today we're going to look at two systems that might change what we do. The first one we brought forward by the Health Policy Commission. The second one will be brought forward by Dr. John McConnell. These are for discussion only. These are discussion. These are possibilities. These are not going into legislature necessarily. We're not talking about making any bills up from them. This is for discussion only today. So it's the first time we're going to talk about different systems we could be looking at that might make a real change. I've always thought also that, in a situation like we're in where we're trying to bring forth policy, my experience has been, as many people have heard before, that success has many fathers, but failure has none and is an orphan. And remember that as we go through this, it takes a certain amount of courage to really step up and make decisions and try to bring forward new policies in a world which does not always accept them very well. Having said that, I'm going to ask for a few comments from my co-chair, Senator Westland, if you'd like to. Rarely he doesn't. Hearing none, I'm asking Gretchen Moore to come up. And Gretchen, would you like to outline Oregon Health Policy Commission's update for us? Oh, do you want to speak? Oh, we had a chance. I thought you would speak. That's as much as my wife ever gave to me. I mean, that's it. Glenn.
I have some very important words.
Congratulations, Mitch, on your 50th anniversary.
And Rick is reminding me of a wise thing to do also. Let's go around and introduce ourselves again because we have people filling in, and those who are new to the commission or filling in for you might benefit from that.
Mike Becker, Region.
Louise Moycroft is Health System.
Bruce Goldberg, Department of Human Services.
Ken Allen, AFSCME.
I'm Mitch Greenwick, Oregon Health Representative.
With Bill Patsman, Health Services.
John Palmer, OSHA.
Mel Becky, Orleans for Health Security.
Gretchen Worling, Director of Oregon Health Policy Commission.
Steve Howard, Mid-Valley FDA.
Monica Webby, Oregon Medical Association.
Weston Herringer, Oregon Dental Association.
I'm Steve Beckerzelli, Willamette Dental.
I cop a DACA, Governor's Small Business Council.
Carl Wojciechowski, Fred Meyer.
John Dutrinsky, OHS Youth, and in for Norwood, Matt Richardson.
Frank Morris, State Senate.
Ben Russman, State Senator from the best Senate district in the entire state.
Rick Jacobian, City Administrator.
I'm a state senator also from the best district in the state. Unfortunately, I don't suffer from hallucinations, as the gentleman to my right does.
Okay.
Rick.
Just a comment before we start. Cotter, in his books, The Heart of Change, talks about the importance of anchoring change in your emotion and understanding why we change things. And it struck me that yesterday I was called to see a 37-year-old diabetic who died at home as a medical examiner. And this is a man who couldn't afford his medications, had been in the hospital in July. We had been supplying him with the medications as best possible, but became his diabetes got out of control. He chose not to go to the hospital, and he died at home. And there's nothing more frustrating than to see a young person's life lost because of concerns about ability to access health care. You know, that's why we're here, and I think it's very important that we remember people like that when we look at how we need to change the system. So, just, you know, this is important work, and yesterday we just drove that home.
Thank you, Rick. Just so we can know what we're going to be doing today as far as time sequence are concerned, Gretchen, we're going to have you present first. We expect that Governor Kitzhaber will be in at about 10. He'll be on sort of a tight schedule. So if we haven't finished discussing your issues, we'll come back to that after he leaves. And I'm sorry it'll be sort of a disjointed presentation for you. We'll go from one to the other, then back again. And then Dr. McConnell will bring you on after that. Is that okay? So Gretchen, you want to bring forward what you've got?
Sure. For the record, I'm Gretchen Moore, Director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Thank you for having me here this morning. You should have in front of you a one-pager that outlines at a very top level some of the ideas that the Commission has been talking about. The Commission has been doing quite a bit of hard work, not only during the meetings, but also in small group meetings and within their work groups to flesh out a proposal that is something that the state can do right now, and that this is somewhat what differentiates what the Commission is doing with, from some of the other health reform efforts in terms of where we're going is what it is the state can do now, practically between now, next 5 years. It isn't necessarily mutually exclusive from, say, what Governor Kitzhaber will be talking to you about. I think the idea is that we wanted to make sure that the resources in the state were being used wisely this year as people were looking at reform efforts. We didn't want to be duplicating efforts, and we really thought that looking at what the federal constraints currently are on the state and working a reform plan around that was a niche that the Commission could be biting off while you had some of these other efforts going on in terms of tackling some of the federal challenges. So hopefully what comes out of the Commission is complementary to what comes out of, say, the Archimedes movement and this this commission as well, and any other groups that are looking at different ideas. So that's sort of the upfront comment, I would say, the staging of what I'm going to talk about. If you look at the one pager, the goal, which can be, you know, wordsmithed to death in terms of picking the right words, but the idea is we want to move the system towards one that is accessible, coordinated, efficient, has in mind the health of the individual, not just the finance and delivery of healthcare. A lot of these concepts I know everybody is talking about, but just to make sure that people know that the end goal for the commission is improving the health of the Oregonians, while the fact that, you know, we're spending most of our time talking about how do we create a system that builds on the current structures and then improves on them and has that outcome of improved health. A couple of other just things I would mention in terms of just broad brush context. We are holding the principle that a plan should bring everybody to the table on reform. Obviously easier said than done. And that what we really want to make sure is that any plan does really integrate the idea that it isn't just about expanding access, that it's about controlling costs, it's about sustainable financing, it's about quality, transparency, and integrating public health and health promotion into with the healthcare system, and not keeping those two large pieces as separate silos. Looking down, you'll see on the reform plan components what might come to your mind immediately looking at the headers: individual coverage mandate, health insurance exchange, public coverage and subsidies, employer contribution. You're thinking probably, how is this different than Massachusetts? Massachusetts did give the commission and other states a place to start in terms of, okay, this is what Massachusetts thought would work for them. Why is that? How can it work for Oregon if it can? And there were a number of pieces of the Massachusetts plan that really made sense to the health policy commissioners, one of them being the individual coverage mandate in terms of bringing everybody into the system. There's been experience in other states that have, a lot of other states, Maine's a good example, that have some great reforms, great new programs, but without something that really brings everybody into the system, there's a real weakness there. The health insurance exchange idea, which is called the connector in Massachusetts, is one that was very appealing to the commissioners in terms of creating a central forum that's a real smart buyer in the system. It's one more leverage point in terms of pushing the system forward on efficiencies, cost control, a one-stop shopping place for accessing not only affordable products if you're a small employer and individual, but also a place where you can access the public subsidies as an individual, maximizing pre-tax options, as well as increasing portability. And this is where a lot of the staff research is going on right now in terms of how far can we push this? Excuse me. How far can we push this exchange idea? How can it really be a cornerstone of the system to push forward what everybody is talking about in terms of cost control, efficiency, and access? One second. In terms of the public subsidies, one of the things, as we're taking the approach that we want it to be something that is realistic, implementable in the short term. It obviously requires appealing to a broad spectrum of folks in the state, as well as legislators. And one of the decision points is this idea of wanting to put emphasis in the plan on things such as Dr. Wilpat was just talking about in terms of the emphasis on chronic care management, preventive care, upfront care, making sure people have access to the services that keep them healthy on the front end, balancing that with individual choice and wanting to give people who have the means to purchase what it is they feel works best for them, knowing that they have the resources to finance their care. And where right now the commission is proposing we balance these two things is having the public structure be one more of those leverage points. I keep on using the term leverage point, but one more leverage point in terms of you know, the state, whether it's OMAP or another structure, has a responsibility to be a smart buyer too. And it's through the public subsidy structures where we'd have one more point at which the state would say, if we're going to be spending public dollars, we're going to be spending it in an area that we believe is incenting to right care. And that would be where we propose dovetailing with all the work that's going on the HSC list, and making sure that the public subsidies, if we're using, for say, private insurance premiums, are going towards care that's going to push the system in the direction that we would like. However, the individuals, say, at 400-500% of poverty that are interested in purchasing, say, an HSA, those would be available under the plan. And the array of packages that the exchange would have available would run the gamut of availability, with the idea that public premium subsidies, there might be some sort of a slightly different selection available to them. And those are just thoughts in process, and of course anybody's reaction I would love to get. But like I said, it is trying to get kind of everybody around the table to agree that they see their own interest in this plan. I think, let me just look down the list. I'm trying to hit on the highlights and not read one page word for word for you. I think the bottom section on the one pager hits on some of the things that really where we're doing most of the staff work right now in terms of we obviously need sustainable financing. We obviously need cost control measures. We had some state staff who just this past week went to a reinsurance institute in New York looking at what New York's doing in terms of the state reinsurance pool. We'll be looking at that as an option for the state. Overall delivery system improvements, we have some work groups, the Safety Net Advisory Council that's looking at some recommendations there. We have our Quality and Transparency Work Group that is working up a set of recommendations. And the piece that's not on this one pager is also that we'll be making recommendations on sequencing in terms of if you were to move the system in this direction, how the reforms should be implemented for the greatest impact. I think with that, the one other thing I would mention is the one thing that the commission is grappling with, which everybody is when they really start getting down to brass tacks on a reform plan, is this a question of affordability and what that means. And the commission we've done some very basic analysis looking at what household costs are for a median income family, what that leaves left over for health insurance, does that give us a range of affordability? It's obviously not an exact science. There's not a resource as to where to go on this, but at this point, in terms of just doing some basic modeling and pricing of this type of plan for Oregon, we're pegging just some basic percentages just to get a sense of kind of the percentages of what somebody should, a family could pay for health insurance, kind of in quotes, could pay. Just to get a sense of what we're talking about in terms of costs for a plan like this. So we're trying not to let the enemy of the good. Just get something down, and then we can have a dialogue about whether this gets us in the direction that we want to go.
Thank you, Gretchen. I want to take a few minutes, and if everyone else agrees, go through this piece by piece with you a little bit more. I have questions, I'm sure others do too. First off, do other commission members have any questions for Gretchen at this point? Hearing none. Gretchen, let's just take each one of these topics one by one if we could, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Your individual coverage mandate, this is obviously a lot like a Massachusetts plan. You obviously had some discussions on this. What kind of penalties do you think you're looking at, and how you require people to get into the plan? Any of those kind of discussions? And how far down, how much have you gotten into this stuff?
I think around the individual coverage mandate, I think the two areas that I would say the commission's focused on the most, one is the question of affordability, like I was just talking about. How do we shape it in terms of affordability? The second one is around what would satisfy the requirement of an individual mandate. And right now the commissioners are feeling somewhat comfortable in saying that the state's already broad definition of insurance is enough to ensure that people wouldn't be, say, purchasing a single condition plan to satisfy an individual mandate. I don't think, other than no one really having a problem necessarily with the Massachusetts approach, which is going through the state personal tax deduction, as well as, I think, in subsequent years, isn't something like no more than 50% of the average cost of a available package or something. I don't know the exact words for Massachusetts, but we haven't actually debated beyond that.
Would broad insurance definitions include catastrophic insurance as a broad definition of insurance, you think?
Well, I think every time we, and I, you know, Rick can also jump in since he's a part of all these conversations too.
Hey, Rick, you're strangely silent over there.
I think in general, when you ask somebody about what a basic package should have on the commission, 9 times out of 10, I would say they would want the upfront care like Rick talks about, like we were just talking about, as well as some catastrophic component. Beyond that, I'm not, I mean, any more, defining it any more than that, we haven't gone there.
Yes. Representative Greenwood.
I'd just like to comment a bit on this. I think underlying this perception is the symbolic need to point out that everybody needs to be a part of the system. And the commission has been focusing on that symbolic need, employer mandate, individual mandate, get everybody involved and let the details float for a moment until we can fix that as a basic concept. But I think ultimately how that gets proposed is going to have to be made pretty clear.
And I'm sorry, I also have to agree, like, obviously it's part of all these conversations as well.
Gretchen, are you talking about wanting everybody to buy, when you're talking about everyone seeking out affordable insurance, are they able to buy insurance from any insurance company, or are you talking about everybody contributing into the same insurance entity? So you're just saying you want everybody to get however they choose to get it, individual insurance.
Right. Through whatever mechanisms, the insurance exchange would ideally be offering a central component that would offer more options and give, say, small businesses hopefully more affordable options is the idea. But it's adding one more option, not telling everybody they need to change where they're currently purchasing insurance to satisfy the mandate.
Follow up on that?
Yes.
It sort of moves us to the next piece, the exchange. And I guess what I was really interested in is whether or not it's an exchange or an opportunity to actually pool purchasing power. Because there's two ways of looking at that. One is, you know, it's an exchange. You get information, it's a nice billboard, and you can, find a health plan near you. The other is, a mechanism to help, pool purchasing power so that not everybody is so you can get more affordable health care. And I just wondering if there's been some real thinking about that.
We have been having some groups thinking about that. I'm not sure I'm necessarily the best person to relay all the details of those conversations. Yeah, definitely some good thinking going on. It is, the intention is to do what you're saying, Bruce, in terms of pushing it to that next level, not having it just be a clearinghouse of information, which would be helpful in its own right, but really going beyond that to having it be one more strong purchaser in the market, as well as in being able to do some of that pooling. Obviously, knowing the large number of small businesses we have in Oregon, being able to figure out what we can do there is hopefully can take us a little bit farther than where we are today.
Mayor Beth.
So, Gretchen, has the Policy Commission, have they talked at all about what the price tag would be? Have you seen any numbers on what we've been spending and what individuals would be paying? If we go by the Massachusetts model, the employer component of that is I would hope all of us around this table would be largely insufficient, $295 a year per employee as a fine or a fee if one doesn't provide health insurance. I'm wondering if you all have spoken about that at all. And then again, kind of the individual component. Currently, as you all know, I mean, individuals have no power in the marketplace in terms of trying to buy affordable health insurance. So to follow up on Dr. Goldberg's point, you know, that whole concept of, you know, the more in the pool, the better negotiating power we would have to get affordable health care, whatever that definition turns out being. I'm just wondering if you have been discussing that definition.
Okay, let's see if I can handle your questions.
Yes, I'm glad to ask questions.
I was cataloging them while you were talking. The first one around numbers and the cost, that's actually to your right. John and state staff are working in terms of putting together a very, very top-level model in terms of taking currently available data and cobbling it together, having some group kind of recommendations around where we think people will go if you set up a system that looks like this, just to get some numbers to this. I mean, we're not there yet, but hopefully in the next month. In terms of the employer fee, we've had a lot of discussion about that, and it's true, people's first reaction in Massachusetts is that it's way too low, and it's also not necessarily based on something that you can peg. It's, you know, a number multiplied times 5 and then subtracted some or something.
Well, especially it started at $895, right? So
I think right now we're in the process of looking at some alternative options for the basis of that fee. There are extensive discussions around what's too high that would start, say, whacking out the market in a way that you wouldn't want to. I have heard some people talking about that actually the overall cost of the plan and negative consequences are actually minimized if you launch it without an employer fee at first. So I think it's not as straightforward in terms of it's not necessarily a great financing source for the plan. The higher it is, the more likelihood you're going to have some market issues. So right now we're looking in the ballpark, if not higher. I think everybody has that first reaction of, that's really low. But like I said, we're looking at some options there. I mean, in terms of the individual pooling, I think I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, if we can figure out a way collectively to have something, this exchange plus, maybe we should call it exchange plus because it's a little bit more than just information, to do that type of pooling for individuals, that would be fantastic. So the intention's there. We're just doing the technical investigation.
Could you possibly explain to me, I'm not quite getting my arms around the health insurance exchange. How does that differ from what we have now with insurance brokers? When a small company wants to go buy health insurance, now they go to a broker. Broker offers a choice of usually 6, 7, 8 plans. They're all different premiums, different benefits. They may have an HSA involved, may not. There's all kinds of selection out there. How does the health insurance exchange differ from that?
Well, I think there's definitely aspects that are similar in terms of the role. I think I think there's a number of things. At the top of my head, I would say if you're talking about creating a central one-stop place where people can go to find out not only insurance plan options, but what type of subsidies they might be eligible for. That's a big sort of connection point that you couldn't do if it was completely separate from government. We have had a number of conversations about this, the governing structure of a health insurance exchange, and that most people seem to be migrating towards the sort of quasi-public, some kind of public-private partnership, not necessarily 100% public entity. But I think that, I'm trying to think of what else in terms of, I think the pooling power, if you take it to the next level, that it's not just connecting you with the insurance product, it's bringing people into a pool and being able to bring the prices down. If there was some kind of, say, reinsurance mechanism that was attached to it, you know, the exchange would have a hand in that. It also creates a nice segue between benefit package design and, say, all the work that's gone on with the Health Services Commission. So I think it can be, you know, we can push this idea as far as it works for Oregon, and I think it needs to be tailored to Oregon, given that we have a very specific public financing structure that's, you know, that's different than every other state.
I guess just from my point of view, you would have to make that be a significant change and improve the system. I have to see it as something that would allow pooling of insurance for small employers and for individuals. This is both for small employers and individuals, obviously. I'm reading that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to have pooling in it, which I didn't see explicitly placed here, as a minimum. And other than that, I don't see how it's different than just having the brokers do what they do now. I think.
But that's the same, you're kind of thinking the same way that that's what I was getting at before.
Right.
If you're not all, basically, it sounds like if you're just telling everybody that they have to have a minimum insurance, you're really not changing anything from the way it is now, other than.
At first, I think it's not as straightforward in terms of, it's not necessarily a great financing source for the plan. The higher it is, the more likelihood you're going to have some market issues. So right now we're looking in the ballpark, if not higher. I think everybody has that first reaction of, that's really low. But like I said, we're looking at some options there. I mean, in terms of the individual pooling, I think I couldn't agree with you more. If we can figure out a way collectively to have something, this exchange plus, maybe we should call it exchange plus because it's a little bit more than just information, to do that type of pooling for individuals, that would be fantastic. So the intention's there. I'm just doing the technical investigation.
Could you possibly explain to me, I'm not quite getting my arms around the health insurance exchange. How does that differ from what we have now with insurance brokers? When a company, a small company, wants to go buy health insurance, now they go to a broker. Broker offers a choice of, say, 6, 7, 8 plans. They're all different premiums, different benefits. They may have an HSA involved, may not. There's all kinds of selection out there. How does the health insurance exchange differ from that?
Well, I think there's definitely aspects that are similar in terms of the role. I think there's a number of things. At the top of my head, I would say if you're talking about creating a central one-stop place where people can go to find out not only insurance plan options, but what type of subsidies they might be eligible for, that's a big sort of connection point that you couldn't do if it was completely separate from government. We have had a number of conversations about this, the governing structure of a health insurance exchange, and that most people seem to be migrating towards the sort of quasi-public, some kind of public-private partnership, not necessarily 100% public entity. But I think that, I'm trying to think of what else in terms of I think the pooling power, if you take it to the next level, that it's not just connecting you with the insurance product, it's bringing people into a pool and being able to bring the prices down. If there was some kind of, say, reinsurance mechanism that was attached to it, the exchange would have a hand in that. It also creates a nice segue between benefit package design and, say, all the work that's gone on with the Health Services Commission. So I think it can be, you know, we can push this idea as far as it works for Oregon, and I think it needs to be tailored to Oregon, given that we have a very specific public financing structure that's different than every other state.
I guess just from my point of view, you would have to make that be a significant change and improve the system. I have to see it as something that would allow pooling of insurance for small employers and for individuals. This is both for small employers and individuals, obviously. I'm reading that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to have pooling in it, which I didn't see explicitly placed here as a minimum. And other than that, I don't see how it's different than just having the brokers do what they do now. I think.
But that's the thing, you're kind of thinking the same way that that's what I was getting at before. If you're not all, basically, it sounds like if you're just telling everybody that they have to have a minimum insurance, you're really not changing anything from the way it is now, other than maybe reducing the number of people who are uninsured by people that can afford insurance and just aren't buying it now because they don't think they need it and they're just not buying it. So maybe you're reducing the amount of people who are uninsured, but then if you're not pooling the money together for the same type of insurance policy, I don't see how we're providing any more funds to cover people that aren't funded already. Basically, you're just saying, okay, if you can afford insurance, buy it, but from whoever you want to buy it, as long as you've got this basic coverage. But then you still, so maybe you lower that number of uninsured, so we've got a smaller pool that now we have to cover. But unless we're all pooling together, I don't see how there's any more money available to cover anybody else.
I don't know if I'm just missing something, but... The underlying assumption of the affordability is that if the insurance, the extent to which the insurance is unaffordable for an individual, it will be subsidized in one way or another for their purchase.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems to me that's obviously got to come from public funds. So the question is, if there's a mandate to purchase affordable insurance, if you can afford it, you purchase it. And if you don't, it's subsidized in part or in whole, it seems to me, as a basic. I mean, that is, I'm sure, a basic assumption of what we've been talking about.
And one thing that's not on here, and actually it was an oversight, that the term pooling was not on this one page. The issue around individuals and access to subsidies, and one thing the commission has talked about was requiring going through the exchange for access to the individual subsidies, which does bring everybody in terms of that pooling issue there, or at least a large chunk of
the uninsured people that aren't buying their own, right?
That can't afford
them. Right, right.
Rick, you want to say something?
Well, just that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around the issue of what benefit package should look like. And this is where, you know, Representative Greenlick and I have disagreed some in that, I think we need to be having at least a basic benefit package that is required. And everybody knows I'm not a great fan of high deductibles as a, quote, form of insurance. So I think that issue is still somewhat out there. And correct me if I'm wrong, Gretchen, I do believe we sort of came to an agreement that if there was a public subsidy involved, that there would be a minimum requirement. And if the person was buying on their own, that, you know, they would still have the option of, you know, a high deductible with HSA. So there is a discussion out there. The two points that I felt were critical that are still somewhat up in the air is what is a defined benefit package, and secondly, what do we do about Medicare? And that Medicare is really a broken system that this doesn't address, and that we're going to have to at some point agree to look at that. And the commission has agreed with that statement, but further than that, they haven't said what they would do with Medicare. I do think in terms of the benefit package, using the list has been an agreed upon approach, and I think the more we can standardize that and use that across our state, I think the better off we'll be in terms of defending the program.
One area I would also mention that where some of the staff research is going into now is, and I think we do have a bullet on the reference to administrative burden for small employers. And I think some of the research is how far can we push this idea in terms of taking some administrative burden, whether it's around COBRA, whether it's around the issue of the 125 plans. I mean, just what is it that this central exchange could do for small employers? And actually, I will be going out to the Governor's Small Business Council meeting next week to hear their ideas as well. And, I think it's you'd like to say sky's the limit for this idea, but it really is. What can we do as a state to have this be an attractive option that increases the possibility of pooling and reducing premium costs?
I
The issue of a pool or an exchange, if you will, is one of the things that we've had a lot of discussion around with small business throughout the state. Our last Governor's Small Business Council, which was, well, Senator Westland, you're in Bend, it was held in Bend, we had, Senator Bates had asked that I approach the Governor's Small Business Council on their thoughts as to an employer mandate and also businesses that would be in attendance on what their feeling was with regards to an employer mandate. Now, in that area, we had eight businesses represented or attending the Governor's Small Business Council from the Bend area, one of the largest employers of 475 employees, all the way down to a CPA firm of 13 employees. What was interesting is all eight of these businesses are currently providing health care coverage for their employers or employees. They were adamantly opposed to any type of mandate. Okay. Now, that's from employers providing health care insurance. The reason being there were too many unknown components as to what that mandate would entail and so forth. So in subsequent meetings that we've had, the pooling issue has come up. But prior to that, one of the things that we did is we asked, what needs to be clarified for you as a business owner, a small business owner? It came up with four issues. What would an essentials benefit package consist of? That was number one. Number two, what would the cost for this package of essential benefits be? Three, flexibility for employers to buy up additional benefits in their health care benefits package. Four, what cost containment provisions would there be to ensure that future cost increases would not once again make health care coverage for employees unaffordable? Those were the top four issues that businesses throughout the state of Oregon are asking to be clarified. Now, with pooling is what they feel very strongly about. Establish state health care coverage pool. Essential that as many as possible, if not all, employers participate in the pooling in order to achieve the best cost and buying power of benefits. The pooling cost will need to be attractive so as to encourage willing participation. The attraction should be a better cost factor for employers currently providing benefits and affordable for those who aren't able to afford coverage for their employees. Now, the approach that business is now taking is, first of all, we realize as small business owners that we need to provide health care coverage for our employees. The problem is the cost for these benefits has now created a situation where we're looking at a tipping point where Oregon business is beginning to ask, what is that tipping point? Where can we no longer afford to provide coverage? One of the things that came up at the Bend meeting, one of the Oregon employers from the Bend area, who is also a Governor Small Business Commission member, recently went from 63 employees to 13. And it's because he reached that tipping point. What did he do? He went to an employer outsourcing company, temp service. The 13 employers that he kept were all key employees or managers. He reached that tipping point. He doesn't want to worry about health care coverage anymore. He's putting that burden on somebody else now. So that's the danger that we're starting to face here. Now, what business said is, okay, what we need to do is create an incentive, not a mandate. Let's create these incentives that make it so that businesses want to participate in this and can afford to participate in this. And the pooling thing is one of the things that business is really looking at and wanting some answers to. Now, just my last comment on this, even when it comes to the pooling, one of our concerns is the startup business. Sole proprietorship with maybe two employees. Okay. For us, our average cost per employee is approximately $470 per month per employee. With the exception of this last year, we have, for the last 8 years, experienced double-digit increases in our health care premiums. A startup business, I can tell you right now, will not be able to afford that and will be very resistant to that. Obviously, what we're very interested in as the Governor's Small Business Council is to be able to, in our position paper, support the efforts that come forth to this if we do indeed believe that they are reasonable and its impact on small business isn't going to be a negative impact. The pooling is critical.
Mike, let me ask you a couple of questions about what you just discussed, and others may want to ask you also. And Carl, this might go to you also. There's two components to your cost for health care. One is the premium you actually pay to buy your insurance, whether from an insurer or your self-insurer. The other piece is how much time and effort you have to put into doing that. The efforts of your time to pick a policy, or Carl, maybe more in your case, in a smaller business, the difficulty of managing and watching that health policy and watching deductibles and managing deductibles or an HSA joint there. How much of that is still a major factor for your health care costs? Is it a very small component or something significant? If you were relieved of that, would it be worthwhile, or is it not that significant for you? Mike first.
One of the things that we looked at to make this attractive will be a tax credit. What we started to explore is what would be affordable for a small business or a startup business so that it wouldn't be a burden that would be detrimental to the business existence. One of the things that we feel that, well, I'll just read this right here from the group discussions. A consensus exists that healthcare premiums for small business, that's anywhere from 1 to 10 employees, need to be in the range of $200 to $225 per employee per month range. Okay. Now, we did a cost factor as to what this would actually be for a small business. Let's see. Tax credit to employers amount to be determined of total insurance premium payments. Information should be provided so that employers can calculate the actual cost of health care benefits. Now, take into account here, what we're discussing here is that premium of anywhere from that range of $200 to $225 a month. Assume a small employer is a sole proprietorship with average marginal tax rates of federal 28%, Medicare 2.9%, and state 9% for a total tax rate of 39%, 39.9%. Assuming a cost of $250 per month per employee, net of tax, the cost to the employer is $150 per month. Obviously, this would vary depending on the tax rate. If there were a 10% Oregon tax credit, the net cost to the employer would drop to $125 per month. This is a very reasonable cost to keep a stable and healthy workforce and fulfill a responsibility to the workforce. This is what Oregon's business is starting to feel here, okay, that they can get behind something like this. Obviously, the concern is your startup ventures.
Can you run those costs by us one more time? That $250?
Yeah. Okay. A consensus exists that the health care premiums for small business, 1 to 10 employers, uh-huh, or employees, need to be in the range of $200 to $225 per employee per month. Now, the breakdown, prior to a tax credit, assume a small employer is a sole proprietorship with average marginal tax rates of federal 28%, Medicare 2.9%, and state 9% for a total tax rate of 39.9%. Assuming a cost of $250 per employee per month for health care coverage, the net of tax to the cost to the employer is $150 per month. Now, with an Oregon tax credit, let's say of 10%, that drops to a net cost to the employer of $125 per month. What we did in coming up with that, we had three or four CPA firms work on this as to what that would be.
The
Did you try to compute the other direction of what that would cost the state of Oregon in tax credit? It'd be an interesting number too. I have to look at that.
Okay. But, thank you. Well, what's frightening to Oregon business is not knowing what the answers are to those four issues. What is an essential benefit package? What is going to be the cost of that?
Cost. That's, and I agree with you. I mean, if you set up a system like you described, that's great. But if you haven't got something to contain cost, if you don't know what that cost, if it's adequate, that's, you've got a lot of other questions there.
Right. And one of the things that they're seeing is that no cost containment. This may work for a year. This may work for two. So we're going to be right. The fear will be right back where we were.
Carl?
Well, in the larger companies, I think most of them are self-insured. And so if we were to give up the control of that to something else, we'd have to be looking at some assurances on cost control. Because right now we can move things around, we can offer different plans, and that can control. The other thing, on the 225, 250, does that include any employee contribution?
No.
That's just a, okay.
Mr. Chair?
I think there would have to be some employee contribution into
that. Point of view. And from your point of view, many big companies are now self-insured.
Yes.
And they do that because they feel have control.
Right.
A better chance for control.
Yes.
Have you found your costs still going up a double digit or so?
No.
Where is it going up at?
Around 6-7%.
Manage to hold costs down by having some control. Mary Beth, you're next, then we'll come back over here. Mary Beth?
So, Ike, I'm really actually happy that your work has been going on because and it's very exciting because we are not very far apart, I think, all of us around this room. But I have a couple of questions for you. One is that with the goals that the small business folks were talking about in Bend about universality, which I think is incredible, but how do you get to the universal everybody in concept without a mandate? Is my question. Like, how do we make that work if it's a voluntary way?
Well, the discussions that we've had on that at this point, we've only had one meeting to begin to tackle that. The initial group that came together to put these points together, we put together a summary. And now what we realize that we need to do is actually tackle the individual issues and say, okay, from a business perspective, how do we provide the incentives for all of business to participate? Well, we feel very strongly that a pool will be critical to that, especially in the marketing efforts and selling this. It's going to be critical. Also, the cost containment portion.
Right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. Now, there are many other issues that employers are concerned about, and they feel that also need to be resolved, and they're very interesting. End-of-life care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're very concerned about that. They realize that as a driving force for increased costs, that's critical. Business also feels very strongly about the component of individual accountability. In other words, life choices and so forth, individual life choices. But we're going to have to sell it to small business, and it needs to be something that they feel comfortable with that's going to give them relief of what it has there.
So I'm very happy that you keep talking about cost containment because I do want to remind the commissioners that and the members of the Health Policy Commission that are sitting here and you, Gretchen, that's one of the flaws with Massachusetts. There really is no cost containment. So I just want to repeat that. The other thing, Ike, that I'd be interested in is, you know, and we've talked a little bit offline about this, but what about two different concepts? One is that we assess a fee to all employers in the state, every single one, regardless of whether they provide health insurance or not, and then those employers that are currently providing health insurance do get some kind of tax credit. I don't know what the math is and the impact to the state rates, but, Senator, I'm sorry. so that's one piece. The other is what about if, you know, we don't create some new pool, but we go to that public-private partnership aspect that you were mentioning, Gretchen, and everybody, you know, we have the Oregon Health Plan currently on life support, but if we go back again to the 2002 benefit level within the Oregon Health Plan, it was a pretty robust package of services for folks. And I remember drafting legislation in the 2003 session that I believe, and you know, my brain is not what it used to be, that it was about $263 to provide this package of benefits. This seems to me that we do not have to reinvent the wheel. We've got the basis of this stuff, and so why not have everyone get into that existing pool? Yes, we're going to have some of the sick folks that are on Medicaid, but we all know that this is spreading the risk amongst us. So I'd just be very intrigued with your thoughts on that. And then, Gretchen, I'd like to know just how the exchange is different from kind of the FEOP thing that we have now, OHP plus standard, etc.
I don't have a real good answer. Well, in fact, I'm just going to say I don't have an answer for you on that. It is something that we're beginning to look at. But let me give you an example. My wife's business has just completed its first year in business. She has a staff of 19. Only 3 are employees. The rest were all set up as subcontractors. And the driving force for that decision is the cost of health care insurance. For the 3 employees that she does have, she provides health care coverage for. Now, this is a brand new business established last September. And the driving force in how that business was structured was health care costs.
I'd like to ask Ike a couple questions. First, Mary Beth, I think the $268 you quoted was medical only.
I'm sure. All I know is that
that doesn't include mental health, you know, dental health. Anyway,
request you do that again.
I think everybody around the table realizes it, but the concept that there is such a thing as, quote, insurance is really, I've sort of given up on. What we're really doing is spreading costs. There is no such thing as free health care. So to get down to $250 or $225 a month, you either need to reduce the benefits, because you're talking about half the average cost of health care per capita in this country. You either need to reduce the benefits or you need to subsidize from somebody else. So the question is, if we're going to subsidize small employers, where does that come from? Does it come from large employers? Does it come from, you know, taxes, tax structure, so on and so forth? Apparently, with a tax credit, it has to come from taxes. The other question is, to what extent do you think, in this environment, are employers willing to limit choice for their employees, both choice of benefits and choice of, you know, maybe providers, to control costs? Because, you know, the one point in the last 10 or 15 years we saw where costs were controlled was when managed health care came in and went out because of lack of choice. So two questions are, who's going to pay the bill, and are people willing to limit their choice enough to get down to that kind of cost level?
Well, I think at this point, the feeling from business is that we don't have enough answers to a lot of these questions that they currently have. For example, what is the essential benefits package? Okay, as a starting point. I think one of the other things that was just mentioned here, there's $225 to $250 fee or cost factor that we came up with. Now, bear in mind, what we're thinking is an essential benefits package. I think the other thing that needs to be looked at is an employee contribution. And I think that begins to address the issue of where is some of this money going to come from? Okay.
I think I'm going to start a conversation just for a moment, okay? As I said earlier, we're going to stop and give Governor Kitsoff a chance to present to us. He's been very gracious to us now from his time to their early event. So before we can get out of it. What you may have heard is a discussion before us, going on the very early think you'll enjoy it. Well, if it's not urgent, you'll enjoy it. For those of us who have the pleasure here before, we'll have a chance to do it again. And I'm going to turn over to the governor right now and ask that he be allowed to give his discussion his thoughts. And after we're going to take some questions at that point. The governor? We're on.
Yeah, people know.
Doesn't have too much.
I want to miss a golden rule.
What?
Don't want to miss a golden
rule. Yeah, right. Well, thank you very much for the chance to come down here. It's good to see some of my old friends and associates again after a few years. So I appreciate the chance. What I'm hoping that I can do this morning is give you an overview of sort of my perception of what the problem is, how we got here, and then some thoughts on how we can get out of it, and hopefully that will inform the work that this commission's doing and whatever product you ultimately decide to bring in to the legislature. There are a couple of points that I hope you take away from this, and the most important ones are that if you cannot control the cost in the system, you haven't accomplished anything. We want to keep people healthy, but what's really driving the politics and driving the pressure in the system is the cost in the system, and you have to get at the cost. Secondly, you cannot get at the cost if you simply look at financing and access. Massachusetts, California, most of the proposals at the state level today are about how to expand access and pay for it, and that does almost nothing to deal with the cost side. I don't think the problem of the uninsured is the central problem. I think it's a symptom of the problem. Everyone on Medicare has insurance coverage, and that's the program that's going to break the bank, and I'll come back to that in just a second. So you can't solve this problem if you just look at financing and access. What you have to look at are three other things. You have to look at how we define a benefit and how that benefit is delivered. If you don't get into the delivery system and what it is we're delivering, you're not going to solve the problem. The heavy politics, I think, are in the delivery system. Raising money to expand access is simple. It's not easy politically, but it's a simple equation. Changing the delivery system is extraordinarily complicated, but that's, I think, where the real cost savings are. Secondly, you can't do this unless at some place you deal with limits. Someplace you acknowledge that we can't do everything for everybody. And somehow that has to be taken into account. And third, you can't do this, in my estimation, unless you look at the huge public subsidies that are currently in the system. If you leave Medicare off the table, if you leave Medicaid off the table, if you leave our employer-sponsored system off the table and don't look at any one of those three programs, then I don't think you can be successful. Well, thank you very much for the chance to come down here. It's good to see some of my old friends and associates again after a few years. So I appreciate the chance. What I'm hoping that I can do this morning is give you an overview of sort of my perception of what the problem is, how we got here, and then some thoughts on how we can get out of it, and hopefully that will inform the work that this commission's doing and whatever product you ultimately decide to bring in to the legislature. There are a couple of points that I hope you take away from this, and the most important ones are that if you cannot control the cost in the system, you haven't accomplished anything. We want to keep people healthy, but what's really driving the politics and driving the pressure in the system is the cost in the system, and you have to get at the cost. Secondly, you cannot get at the cost if you simply look at financing and access. Massachusetts, California, most of the proposals at the state level today are about how to expand access and pay for it, and that does almost nothing to deal with the cost side. I don't think the problem of the uninsured is the central problem. I think it's a symptom of the problem. Everyone in Medicare has insurance coverage, and that's the program that's going to break the bank, and I'll come back to that in just a second. So you can't solve this problem if you just look at financing and access. What you have to look at are three other things. You have to look at how we define a benefit and how that benefit is delivered. If you don't get into the delivery system and what it is we're delivering, you're not going to solve the problem. The heavy politics, I think, are in the delivery system. Raising money to expand access is simple. It's not easy politically, but it's a simple equation. Changing the delivery system is extraordinarily complicated, but that's, I think, where the real cost savings are. Secondly, you can't do this unless at some place you deal with limits. Someplace you acknowledge that we can't do everything for everybody. And somehow that has to be taken into account. And third, you can't do this, in my estimation, unless you look at the huge public subsidies that are currently in the system. If you leave Medicare off the table, if you leave Medicaid off the table, if you leave our employer-sponsored system off the table and don't look at any one of those three programs, then I don't think you can be successful. So let me run through, sort of try to put that into context. But those are the three things that I think are most salient to the work that that you're doing. I think that this crisis in our healthcare system is rapidly becoming probably the most pressing domestic challenge that we face today, not just because of the growing number of people who lack timely access to needed medical care, but because of the implications and opportunity costs of spending an ever-growing portion of our resources on this one sector alone. As some of you may know, since 2003, the cost of Medicaid has started to exceed the cost of primary and secondary education as the largest item in many state budgets, which means as the cost of health care continues to increase, it's going to constrict our ability to invest in schools, in infrastructure, in economic opportunity, and a whole host of things that have a huge impact, not just on the health of our citizens, but the health of our economy and the health of our society. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, because Medicare, the cost of health care, is soon going to become the single largest driver in our $9 trillion national debt. Now, if you remember, about 4 or 5 months ago, the U.S. Congress voted to raise the statutory debt ceiling by $870 million to accommodate a $9 trillion national debt. Now, do you have any idea how much $1 trillion is? I mean, it is a number so staggering that you have to have some frame of reference in order to relate to it. And let me give you one. You should actually go home with your calculator and run this math, because it's pretty hard to believe. 1 million seconds ago was last week. 1 billion seconds ago, Nixon was leaving the White House. 1 billion seconds ago was 30,000 B.C. A trillion seconds ago, 30,000 B.C. So we have this $9 trillion budget deficit, and it's escalating as the population ages. And Congress is concerned with the solvency of Social Security. That's about a $5 trillion long-term problem. When my generation reaches 65, the unfunded entitlement in Medicare is $65 trillion. And how are we paying for that? We're selling securities to Japan and China and other countries that are still willing to buy them. What's going to happen the day China says we're no longer willing to underwrite U.S. deficit spending? That's when we have a stock market crash and a currency crisis and interest rates soar. Now, people will tell you that that won't happen because China wants our economy to be strong so we can buy their goods and services, but the point is it's not our choice to make anymore. We've given that huge part of our fiscal future over to one of our major international competitors. So my point is, the window in which we have to act and shape our own future, as opposed to just reacting to things beyond our control, is rapidly narrowing, and we need to step in and seize the moment. I don't think Congress has the ability right now to actually grasp a big idea, but I believe states like Oregon can put their arms around a big idea and force the debate into our nation's capital. So I have three objectives here in the next 30 minutes, and that is to, first, I want to sort of strip this system down to its component parts so that you can see and really appreciate the contradictions and inequities in the system. And then I want to offer a vision for what I think our healthcare system could look like, what it should look like, and then I want to offer some thoughts on a plan for leadership and direct action where we in the state of Oregon can force the kind of debate that we desperately need in the United States Congress. So let me start with a little story here. I have that next slide. One more. Alan knows this guy. couple of years ago, I took a friend of mine on a rafting trip down the Rogue River in August, and this was someone who was born in inner city New York, had never really been in that kind of wilderness anyway before. And it was, the salmon were running, there were a lot of dead fish, you know, on the banks and fish in the river. We flew by this enormous male Chinook, maybe 35 or 40 pound creature. You know, he's still heading upstream, but he's struggling against the current, against his fading strength, and he's just all torn up. We've seen those big false spawners. He had the scars on his side, and his fins are all shredded, and that white fungus growing on his head. And my friend looks at this fish and says, my God, what is wrong with that fish? And without thinking, I said, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. He's just dying. Now, in this country, we don't adopt the same benevolent view of the great circle of life as the Chinook salmon. And so we act as though death is optional. Dick Lamb, former governor of Colorado, tells this story. He claims to have done a study of death rates all over the world. I'm a little dubious, but he swears he did this in, you know, every country, city, county, every continent. And he discovered this amazing thing. They're all the same. One per person. Now, in this country, through our medical system, we've developed this unlimited array of diagnostic and therapeutic procedures with which we seek to combat disease and disability and stave off the inevitable consequences of aging. And that's produced this huge industry that's committed to not just developing these technologies, but financing and delivering them for the benefit of individuals. And if you look at modern medicine from the individual standpoint, it is miraculous. There's amazing things that we can do and do every day. But if you look at it from a societal standpoint, there's a darker side. Because this problem, this arrangement, wouldn't create a problem if everyone had the ability to pay the cost of his or her own health care. So all the benefits of modern medicine would accrue to the individual, and the individual would finance the cost with their own personal resources. So no public resources would be put at risk. But that's clearly not the case today. Today, we increasingly rely on limited public resources to finance the cost of care for individuals. So the next slide. So my first point today is that what is really in contention here in the healthcare debate, I think, is the allocation of these public resources and who benefits or doesn't benefit from it. We're not really arguing about people's private after-tax dollars. If you can afford the cost of your health care, you're not the problem. I mean, you may think it costs too much, and I think you're probably right, but you're not the system problem. And let me give you an analogy. One of the results of my dual experiences as a doctor on the one hand and a legislator and governor on the other has been this acute awareness of the fact that how I allocate resources as a doctor was a whole lot different than how I was expected to do it as a legislator or as a governor. So as a doctor, my commitment was to the individual in front of me to do whatever I thought was necessary regardless of cost as long as some benefit accrued. And it's probably what you expect when you go to see your physician. As a governor or legislator, you can't ignore cost. And your commitment is to get the greatest health benefit you can for the greatest number of people with the public resources you have available. So public resources are resources held in common. What we try to do usually is to maximize the benefit of that allocation across the population. Next slide, please. Now, if you think about it, that's what we do in most cases. I mean, the fire department doesn't show up at just some structure fires. The police don't respond to just some calls. And all of our kids get access to a publicly subsidized education. So I want to use our public school system for a second to illustrate how we allocate most of our public resources. Now, I'm not saying there aren't problems with our public school system. We all know that there are, so don't take the analogy too far. But what I want you to do is think for a minute about the financing and eligibility structure in our school system, because then I want to compare it to the one in our healthcare system, and you can begin to sort of see how we got into trouble and the steps we have to take in order to get out of it. So in Oregon, and indeed throughout the country, we have a policy that entitles all of our children to a publicly financed education from first grade through 12th grade, right? That's based on a widespread recognition of the importance of education, not just for individuals, but for our society. It's in the public interest to have educated citizens on a whole host of levels, you know, civically, for the workforce, for a whole host of reasons. So to implement the policy, we publicly subsidize our schools with general tax revenues. It used to be mostly property taxes, now it's mostly, in Oregon, mostly income taxes, to make sure they're available to everyone. So everyone who pays taxes contributes to that subsidy. The rich, the poor, people with kids in school, and even people who don't have kids in school. And all of our kids are eligible for this publicly financed education, and they all get the same benefit, if you will, which is the educational experience of 12 years in the public school system. So there's universal access to a basic benefit or level of education. Nobody's left out, and the public pays for the same benefit for everyone. All right? Now, parents who want to give their kids additional educational opportunities, you know, a tutor or enrollment in a private school, they get to do that. But we don't subsidize those additional benefits with our public dollars. And, of course, that's not an option that's available to everyone. It's a function of disposable income. So if you don't have a lot of disposable income, you have to rely on the public school system to educate your kids, which is why it's so important, why it's a cornerstone of a democratic society. It's the floor that we're going to insist everyone has an opportunity to get from an education standpoint. Now, when we face fiscal pressure in the school budget, what is it we argue about? Well, we argue about what's covered, about the benefit. I mean, we complain about PERS and waste and inefficiency and a whole host of other things. I remember the list. But at the end of the day, inadequate revenue is reflected in what's covered, in bigger class sizes or fewer electives or a shorter school year. And that reduction in benefit applies to everyone who's enrolled in the public school system, so it's equitably allocated. What we don't argue about is eligibility. I mean, none of you have ever said, well, we don't have enough money in the 05-07 biennium, so we're not going to teach the 11th and 12th grade. Or this biennium, on your 16th birthday, you can't go to school anymore. Or this year, when you make more than $40,000 a year, you're out until 07. We never question our commitment to eligibility. So everyone stays eligible. Everyone still has access to the same level of education, even if it's been reduced because of fiscal necessity. Now, set that aside for a second, and let's talk about the financing and eligibility structure in the U.S. healthcare system, which is really one of the things I think you cannot leave off the table if you want to seriously address this problem. The U.S. healthcare system didn't really develop, it happened in pieces without any master plan and no sense of common purpose, but certainly not around a commitment to access. It developed around something called categorical eligibility. Now, what does that mean? It means that in the United States, in order to get access to publicly subsidized health care, as opposed to publicly subsidized education or public safety services, you have to fit into a category. And these categories were created through three separate acts of Congress in the last century. The first one was in 1954, when, I'll just go ahead and stay back on that other one, if you would. Yeah. The first one is in 1954, when Congress granted preferential tax treatment to employer-sponsored health insurance coverage. That means that was the point at which we amended the tax code to allow employers to deduct from their taxable income their contribution to their employees' health care and the tax benefit conferred to employees as well. Now, it's interesting to note that the fact that we even have a system of employer-sponsored coverage in this country was really an accident of history. It was a result of the labor shortage in the Second World War when 17 million GIs went off to fight. And normally, employers raise wages to attract and retain workers during the labor shortage, but because of fear of inflation, there were wage and price controls in effect. So employers started offering what in 1945 was a non-monetary benefit, which was employer-sponsored health insurance. Then in 1954, after the war, when Congress granted the preferential tax treatment to this, that's what really cemented the development of over half of our health care system today. The second one took place 11 years later, the enactment of Medicare had nothing to do with the first one, and Medicaid enacted at the same time. So if you think about it, all three of those programs, which made eminent sense at the time they were created, grant a public subsidy or benefit not to all citizens, but just to certain categories. The problem is that the economic and demographic environment in which those three programs exist has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. The programs continue to reflect a set of circumstances that made sense 40, 50 years ago. Okay, the next slide. So, for example, when Congress did grant the preferential tax treatment to employer-sponsored coverage, no one could have imagined that 50 years later we'd have a highly competitive global economy that would put U.S. employers at a competitive disadvantage with businesses in other countries that don't have to pick up the cost of health insurance for their employees. No one could have imagined that the public subsidy involved would grow to about $200 billion a year, a subsidy that's underwritten by everyone who pays taxes, including tens of millions of workers who don't benefit from workplace-based coverage. Now, Medicare, enacted in 1965, was enacted at a time when poverty among the elderly was twice that of the general population. So it was a noble effort to improve financial access for the elderly, most of whom were poor. It's an entitlement program that starts at age 65 regardless of your income, and it's financed largely by taxes paid by people who are still working. The FICA taxes that come out of your paycheck, a chunk of that goes to finance Medicare. It covers acute care, but interestingly enough, not long-term care. Now, that all made sense in 1965. It doesn't make a lot of sense today. 40 years ago, people over the age of 65 were the single poorest segment of our society. Today, people over the age of 65 are the single wealthiest segment of our society, followed only by people between 55 and 65. But because the program isn't means-tested, everyone over the age of 65 is entitled to publicly financed health care, increasingly paid for by tens of millions of working people who cannot afford health care for themselves and their families. Now, Medicaid, the third element of our federal system, was enacted in 1965, and again, it was designed to improve financial access just for certain categories of poor people. To get on Medicare, being poor isn't enough. You have to also fit into one of these categories that were created by Congress, originally kids and poor families on welfare, people who are blind or had a disability, the frail elderly who needed long-term care because Medicare doesn't cover that service, and certain categories of pregnant women. So Medicaid, unlike Medicare, is not an entitlement program. Being poor isn't enough. So as a result, there are tens of millions of deeply impoverished citizens who are not eligible for Medicaid because they don't fit into a category. Poor men, poor women who aren't pregnant without kids. So what we did inadvertently was create a distinction between the deserving poor who fit into a category and then the undeserving poor who don't, but have equal challenges facing access. Okay, next slide. So these three programs created the eligibility and financing structure of the modern U.S. healthcare system that was not designed. It happened at different times for different purposes. And it has two major third-party payers. On the public side, we have Medicare and Medicaid. And on the private side, we have predominantly employer-sponsored coverage. Now, a little under 50% of the money is coming from the public side right now. But as the population ages and the size of Medicare increases and the erosion in employer-sponsored coverage continues, the public side is going to continue to grow. So if you're worried about a great, big, publicly financed healthcare system, don't do anything, because that's where we're heading right now. Now, because this system was developed around categories, not a commitment to access, there's this growing gap between the public and private arms. And if you think about it, the people in the gap are Americans who don't fit into a category. They're not 65, so they don't qualify for Medicare. They don't meet the income or categorical requirements for Medicaid. They don't work for an employer who offers coverage, and they can't afford a policy in the private individual market. Now, we've got probably 600,000 Oregonians in this gap. There's almost 800,000 Washingtonians, almost 50 million Americans. And that doesn't include tens of millions of people who are uninsured and literally one illness away from personal bankruptcy. Indeed, the inability to pay a medical bill is the second leading cause of personal bankruptcy in this wealthy nation, second only to job loss. Now, why does this gap exist? It exists because our system was never developed, designed to ensure everyone has access to it, but rather around these categories. And so what we've managed to do in this country, a great example of American ingenuity, we've been able to avoid answering the most basic question in the healthcare debate that almost every other industrialized nation has answered. And the question is simply this. In this country, at the end of the day, who has the responsibility to finance the cost of healthcare for people who can't pay for it themselves? And because we've never answered that as a matter of public policy, we have allowed by default the economic market to make the answer for us. Of course, markets are designed to make a profit, not to foster social responsibility, so nobody goes out and competes for people that won't pay them. Shouldn't come as a real big surprise to us. And in my business, people who can pay, who have good insurance, we call them market share. And we want to do business with them. And of course, people who can't pay, we call them liabilities. We do it quietly, but that's what we call them. And we try to avoid seeing them through adverse selection and cost shifting. Now, cost shifting is sort of the dirty little secret in the American healthcare system, but it's also what makes it work. It's also what allows us to avoid confronting the fact that we're the only industrialized nation on planet Earth that hasn't figured out how to get people access to timely medical care on the front end. And here's how it works. When these people get sick enough, they go to the emergency room where federal laws and TALA and others require that they be seen and treated. And then the uncompensated costs are simply shifted back to these third-party payers through incremental increases in their insurance premiums or their bills. So if you have a private policy, probably around 10% of the premium is that cost shift. So you're actually subsidizing our implicit policy of universal access in this country. Now, what do these payers do? Well, they simply shift the cost back on to individuals. So states do it by manipulating income eligibility standards to draw people from Medicaid. So we dropped 70,000 people from the Oregon Health Plan and just not re-enrolling the new eligibles. They're still totally unable to get access to care, but we've been able to manage to hold the budget together. The private sector does it either by dropping coverage altogether, And private sector employer-sponsored coverage is eroding at about 4.5% a year in this country. Most of those are good corporate citizens who simply cannot afford to continue to pick up this growing cost and still remain competitive in a very competitive global economy. Or they increase co-payments and deductibles that increase out-of-pocket expenses for their employees, which is why health care is probably the single leading cause of labor disputes, sometimes work stoppage and lost productivity in the country. And those policies simply drive more people back into the coverage gap who go back to the emergency room, repeating the cycle. Now, this system defies logic and common sense. I can't imagine anyone would design a system with these kinds of contradictions and perversities. But more importantly, it costs us far more economically and financially to leave a large portion of people without coverage than it would be to step up to the plate and figure out how to pay for it on the front end. Because these people get care. On the front end or the back end. And because we don't have an explicit policy of universal coverage, they end up in the ED when they're very, very sick. The only way this arrangement saves money is if we also adopt a policy that says we're going to let Oregonians die in the ambulance for half if they can't pay. And we don't do that. And let me give you an example I'm sure many of you are very, very familiar with. And it was the case of that short period of time in 2003 when we discontinued prescription drug coverage for the OHP basic benefit package and the medical needy program. Now, shortly thereafter, there was a gentleman named Douglas Schmidt, who was in his mid-30s with a seizure disorder, who was no longer able to access the medication that controlled his seizures. And after about 10 days, he had a sustained grand mal seizure, ended up with severe brain damage on a ventilator at Good Sam Hospital. He stayed in the unit there for a number of months. He was transferred to a long-term care facility. He died in November of 2003 when life support was discontinued. Now, the cost of his medication was about $14 a day. The cost of his hospital stay was over $1 million, and it was all billed back onto the state Medicaid program because he was still covered by Medicaid. It just didn't get him access to what he needed on the front end. Now, if you think about it, he died of budgetary and political expediency. Based on a policy that said in effect in the great state of Oregon, we're not willing to pay $14 a day to manage your seizure disorder, but we're happy to kick over $1 million of limited resources to keep you on life support once your seizures have destroyed your brainstem. It's a policy that says we won't pay pennies to manage your blood pressure in the community, but we'll be happy to pick up the cost of managing your stroke after you have it. Well, we won't ensure that all of our women get good prenatal care, but we're happy to pay the cost of resuscitating a 500-gram infant in a neonatal intensive care unit. And that shouldn't be acceptable to us. And it's made no more acceptable by the fact that we don't actually have to confront the faces of the people who are damaged by these choices. Now, that's not going to change as long as we allow our thinking and our reform efforts to be constrained by this 40-year-old financing and eligibility structure, which everyone seems to think you can't possibly put on the table, which reflects the realities of the last century. It'd be like Bill Gates holding on to a 40-year-old operating system expecting Microsoft to be competitive in the 21st century. The place to start, in my estimation, is we need to begin to view our healthcare system with the same eye to equity and sustainability with which we approach the financing and eligibility structure in our public school system. If we did, we'd start by saying, okay, next slide, we'd start by saying, we would try to take these public resources and maximize the health of our population by creating a sustainable system, which puts the cost factor right up front where you can see it, by ensuring that everyone has access to a defined set of effective health services. So everyone would contribute to this basic benefit, to the subsidy of this basic benefit, and everyone would be eligible for it. And people that want to buy additional services above and beyond that, which we can finance with public resources, which is going to be limited because of the constraints on public budgets, are free to purchase them. But we wouldn't subsidize those additional expenditures with public resources. So, for example, if you want to go out and buy a very expensive brand-name drug that you just saw on the Super Bowl, but a much cheaper generic is just as effective clinically and just as safe, you should be able to do that. But I question whether we should subsidize the difference with public resources or whether an employer should subsidize the difference. It's about health versus health care. Now, I'm not saying that we should just go out and embrace a Canadian-style single-payer system. There's a lot of ways to do this, and what we create in this country will be uniquely American. But I am suggesting, if I go to the next slide, that we need to demand a different standard for that part of the system that's financed with public resources than for that part that's financed with people's after-tax dollars. And there's two things we ought to demand. First, we should demand that we actually get a health benefit for the dollars we spend on health care. I can tell you, and so can Alan, that health care is not necessarily synonymous with health. I used to have a friend named Woody Myers, who was the benefits manager for Ford Motor Company about 5 years ago, and he told me at that time that Ford was spending more on health care than on steel. Now, Ford can tell you everything there is to know about every kind of steel in the world, where it comes from, its tensile strength, its relative value. It can't tell you anything about what it's getting from this growing expenditure on health care. So we need to demand that we get a health benefit for the dollars we're spending on health care. And secondly, because these are common resources, these are public resources, they should be allocated in a way that benefits everyone, not just some of us. It doesn't leave 600,000 Oregonians or 50 million Americans outside the tent, most of whom are contributing to the very subsidies for which they receive no benefit. Now, using this kind of public education model, for lack of a better word, as the eligibility and financing structure for that part of the system that we're paying for with public dollars, in no way precludes the use of market forces in a new system, nor does it presuppose the role that would be played by employers or by the private commercial insurance industry. It says we're going to demand equity and sustainability and effectiveness of the public dollars we spend on health care. Now, I also want to make it clear that I'm not suggesting in this process that I'm going to describe to you briefly here, that we are setting out with the objective to blow up Medicare and blow up Medicaid and pull the pins out from under our system of employer-sponsored coverage. I'm not saying that. But I am saying if we're serious about fixing this, we need to have the courage to ask ourselves, if we took these same public subsidies that are currently in the system, about $900 billion a year nationally, about $6.5 billion each year in Oregon, and looked at those resources through the lens of the 21st century rather than the middle of the last century, would we allocate them in the same way and create the system we have today? Or would we do it differently? Would we set out to create a system that puts U.S. employers at a competitive disadvantage in a world economy? Would that be one of the outcomes we'd build into our system? Would we create a system that forces middle-income working people with no health insurance coverage to subsidize the health care needs of very wealthy people over the age of 65? Does that meet our test for equity and fairness? Would we set out to create a system that's so expensive that the only way you can pay it is to ring up a $65 trillion tab on your children's credit card? I don't think so. So I'm suggesting that unless we're willing to have that conversation about Medicare, about Medicaid, about our employer-sponsored system, and says, is there a way to allocate these resources differently that makes more sense, we can't get from here to there. With regard to the employer-sponsored system, it's not about saying, let's eliminate the tax benefit. It's stepping back and saying, healthcare is an expense. The tax benefit is an offset against the expense. But the expense is growing a lot faster than the offset. So let's rethink how that system works to see if we can figure out a way to create a sustainable system that keeps people healthy but doesn't break the bank. Now, the case for using this kind of model, if you will, can be strengthened if we take just a moment and compare it to the current system, which, as we just discussed, has no clear policy objective to guide the allocation of these resources. It has no explicit policy of access, no explicit set of subsidies to provide health care for people who can't pay for it themselves. It's a system that deals with fiscal limits by manipulating eligibility rather than thoughtfully looking at benefits based on their relative effectiveness, which was the idea behind the health plan. And it's a system that uses these public resources to subsidize people at one end of the income scale at the expense of people at the other. Now, I suggest to you, if we could figure out a way to expose those inequities and contradictions, no one here would embrace them, no one in Oregon would support them, and no one in our congressional delegation would vote for them. And to demonstrate that to you, I want you to do something called a retro-design exercise. It takes 3 minutes. So your assignment here is that we want to create the U.S. healthcare system as it exists on September 15th, 2006. And your job is to... one thing about what it's getting from disability expenditure on health care. So we need to demand that we get a health benefit for the dollars we're spending on health care. And secondly, because these are common resources, these are public resources, they should be allocated in a way that benefits everyone, not just some of us. It doesn't leave 600,000 Oregonians or 50 million Americans outside the tent, most of whom are contributing to the very subsidies for which they receive no benefit. Now, using this kind of public education model, for lack of a better word, as the eligibility and financing structure for that part of the system that we're paying for with public dollars, in no way precludes the use of market forces in a new system, nor does it presuppose the role that would be played by employers or by the private commercial insurance industry. It says we're going to demand equity and sustainability and effectiveness of the public dollars we spend on health care. Now, I also want to make it clear that I'm not suggesting in this process that I'm going to describe to you briefly here that we are setting out with the objective to blow up Medicare and blow up Medicaid and pull the pins out from under our system of employer-sponsored coverage. I'm not saying that. But I am saying if we're serious about fixing this, we need to have the courage to ask ourselves, if we took these same public subsidies that are currently in the system, about $900 billion a year nationally, about $6.5 billion each year in Oregon, and looked at those resources through the lens of the 21st century rather than the middle of the last century, would we allocate them in the same way and create the system we have today? Or would we do it differently? Would we set out to create a system that puts U.S. employers at a competitive disadvantage in a world economy? Would that be one of the outcomes we'd build into our system? Would we create a system that forces middle-income working people with no health insurance coverage to subsidize the health care needs of very wealthy people over the age of 65? Does that meet our test for equity and fairness? Would we set out to create a system that's so expensive that the only way you can pay it is to ring up a $65 trillion tab on your children's credit card? I don't think so. So I'm suggesting that unless we're willing to have that conversation about Medicare, about Medicaid, about our employer-sponsored system, and says, is there a way to allocate these resources differently that makes more sense, we can't get from here to there. With regard to the employer-sponsored system, it's not about saying, let's eliminate the tax benefit. It's stepping back and saying, healthcare is an expense. The tax benefit is an offset against the expense. But the expense is growing a lot faster than the offset. So let's rethink how that system works to see if we can figure out a way to create a sustainable system that keeps people healthy but doesn't break the bank. Now, the case for using this kind of model, if you will, can be strengthened if we take just a moment and compare it to the current system, which, as we just discussed, has no clear policy objective to guide the allocation of these resources. It has no explicit policy of access, no explicit set of subsidies to provide health care for people who can't pay for it themselves. It's a system that deals with fiscal limits by manipulating eligibility rather than thoughtfully looking at benefits based on their relative effectiveness, which was the idea behind the health plan. And it's a system that uses these public resources to subsidize people at one end of the income scale at the expense of people at the other. Now, I suggest to you, if we could figure out a way to expose those inequities and contradictions, no one here would embrace them, no one in Oregon would support them, and no one in our congressional delegation would vote for them. And to demonstrate that to you, I want you to do something called a retro-design exercise. It takes 3 minutes. So your assignment here is that we want to create the U.S. healthcare system as it exists on September 15th, 2006. And your job is to write the bill that Congress would have to pass tomorrow to create what we have today. Have the next slide. Now, because this is a very serious commission, I mean, anything chaired by Westland and Bates has got to be serious, we're going to give our bill a bold and stirring name, and we're going to call it the Healthcare Equity and Empowerment Act of 2006. And as you all know, in the United States Congress, the title of the bill is not required to be reflected in its content, so we're safe on that grounds. Okay, first slide. The preamble would read like this. Sub 1, there shall be no explicit policy objective adopted to guide the allocation of $900 billion of public resources. Sub 2, no clear responsibility will be assigned to finance the health care for Americans who can't afford to do so themselves. Section 1, categories will be established to differentiate between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. Sub 1, the deserving poor shall include poor women who are pregnant, families with dependent children, and those who are blind or disabled. People in these categories will be entitled to publicly subsidized health care. Now, the undeserving poor shall include all poor men and poor women without children who aren't pregnant. These citizens will be denied publicly subsidized health care no matter how deeply impoverished they may be. Section 2, Sub 1. All those over the age of 65, regardless of their income, shall be entitled to publicly financed health care. Sub 2. All working citizens below the age of 65, regardless of whether they can afford health care for their children and their families, will be required to contribute a portion of their taxes each month to underwrite the health care needs of wealthy people over the age of 65. Section 3. This one is my personal favorite. Sub 1. The public program for the elderly, Medicare, will be prohibited from covering long-term care services in spite of the obvious aging of the population. Sub 2, the public program for the poor, or some of the poor, Medicaid, will be required to cover long-term care services. Sub 3, the elderly who need long-term care services will be required to spend themselves into poverty in order to become eligible for Medicaid, at which point their needs compete directly with those of poor women and children, in many cases their own children and grandchildren. Section 4, the criteria of financial need and ability to pay will not be considered when determining who will be eligible for publicly subsidized health care. Sub 2, the relative effectiveness of various medical interventions in actually producing health will not be considered when deciding which services to purchase. I could go on, but I think I've made my point. Next slide. Nobody could support the policies in the Health Care Equity and Empowerment Act of 2006, but that is our operating system. Those are the policies that shape and constrain the U.S. health care system, and those are the policies that have to be exposed and changed if we're serious about creating a more effective, less expensive, and equitable system. So the question is, how do you go about doing it? And I think there are three key steps involved. The first step, which is really what I've been focusing on over the last year, is you've got to create a clear vision of what you want the new system to look like, or at least that part of it that's financed with our shared common resources. The Roman Senator Seneca once said that no wind is the right wind if you don't know what port you're sailing for. If we can't agree on where we want to go, the chances are pretty good we won't get there. So I'll come back to that. You have to have a vision of where you want to end up. Second, you need to be able to expose the contradictions and inequities in the current system, the things in the Health Care Equity and Empowerment Act, the things that no one would stand up and honestly support. And third, you have to figure out a way to create a tension between the status quo and the vision. Now, the Oregon Health Plan, which many of you have been involved with when it was enacted in about 15 years ago, is a real-life example of the power of this approach. Between 1989 and 1992, this little state that had less than 3 million people was the focal point of the national health policy debate. It wasn't California or Florida or New York, it was Oregon. And the reason is that we passed a bill that was illegal. We basically said, look, we're not going to be constrained by the existing structure of Medicaid. It doesn't make any sense. It was passed in 1965, but this is 1989. So we rewrote federal Medicaid law. We said, we don't believe in categorical eligibility. If you're poor, you're poor. Give us a federal match for all poor people, not just some poor people. We said, we don't have all the money in the world. We want to set priorities based on what works and what doesn't work. And we passed that, even though we knew we couldn't implement it without waivers from the federal government. Okay, next slide. But seeking those waivers forced Congress to either defend the current Medicaid program or look thoughtfully at a more rational way to allocate those resources. And it created this huge debate, national debate. But it was a debate about substance, about limits, about equity, about priorities. And Bob Packwood, who was the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, stuck our bill, our waiver request, into the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1989, which meant that if the feds balanced the budget, we got a waiver. So we put it where no one could ignore it. And it sparked this huge debate. A lot of people don't remember, but in the first presidential election, debate in the 1992 presidential election in St. Louis between Bush and Perot and Clinton, Sandy Van Hoker asked a question about the Oregon Health Plan waiver, to which candidate Clinton said, if I was elected, I'd give him the waiver. So the point is, this little state drove and shaped the national policy debate for that election cycle. We can do it again. Both of our U.S. senators are on Senate Finance. But we have to do it on a much broader scale. So if we were to start here in Oregon and agreed on the general framework, the general principles of what we would want a new system to look like, the values we'd want it to reflect, the outcomes we'd want it to produce, not just for us as individuals, but as an economy and as a community, and enacted that framework through the Oregon legislature, we could, by seeking waivers, challenge the entire structure of this system, not just the Medicaid program. In the next slide. And that's basically what the Archimedes movement is trying to do. It's trying to position Oregon and two or three other states to seek a broad range of waivers from the federal government that will force them to either defend the current system or step back and begin to have a thoughtful discussion about what we have to do in this country to deal with a problem that's beginning to put us all at risk. Now, I'm not going to leave you with the impression that I'm so politically naive as to believe that this process in any way eliminates the stakeholder politics that have created gridlock in Washington, D.C. I mean, they're still alive and well there, and they're going to be alive and well here in Oregon. But I believe that in this state we still have the capacity to have a conversation, the kind of conversation that is no longer possible in Washington, D.C. And in any event, it gives us an opportunity to take a big idea and to act instead of reacting. William Jennings Bryan once said that, I think I got this on a slide, move one more slide. Destiny is not a matter of chance, it's a matter of choice. It's not a thing to be waited for, it's a thing to be achieved. And that's the question I leave before you today. The question is whether we are going to just let this happen to us. It's not like we can't see what's coming. Are we just going to sit around and let this come over the transom, or are we going to try to shape our future with our own hands? The question is whether we still have the capacity in this state to come together as a community. Because if we don't, I think it's very unlikely that the political process by itself is going to resolve this issue. And I think we're a lot better than that. I want to leave you this one final thought that occurred to me the other day. We had an employer meeting in Eugene yesterday, and it struck me that there's a parallel here between what happened in 1989 and the workers' compensation reform. Neil Goldsworth was governor. I was president of the Senate at the time. And as you, many business people remember, the workers' comp rates were just going up and were creating a real problem. Neil took employers and employees, and we're off to Mahoney Hall, he called the Mahoney Hall group. He left us doctors outside the room and the trial lawyers and all the other people who are part of the system. And he got the people who were directly affected, the workers and the employers. And he said, now, if anything were possible, if you let go of whether we can get this through the legislature or not, and all the various stakeholders, how would you create a system that really reflected what you want to happen? And they thought about it, and they came up with a system that focused on increasing workplace safety and a no-fault system, and they brought it out. And no one thought it could pass. The governor called me up, and he said, John, we're having a special session next Monday on workers' compensation. I said, well, Governor, I've got three votes for this in my caucus. I'm one. The second one is May Yee, and the third one is Mike Thorne, who at the time were not sort of the heart of a Democratic caucus. They had people like Dick Springer and Ed Fadley and Jan Wires and Margie Hendrickson there. We ended up getting 12 votes for the bill, and the reason we got the 12 votes is they had a clear vision of where we wanted to end up. And people who wanted to maintain the status quo had to explain why the status quo was better than where we needed to go. We can do that in this state. We can do that in the Oregon legislature. We can agree on where we want to go. And if we can do that, we can force the kind of national debate that we desperately need. And I hope you do. Thanks.
Governor, as Connie agreed to stay and take a few questions from us if you'd like, and please feel free. I've heard this a couple times before, and what usually happens is there's no questions for about 30 seconds, and then everyone starts raising their hands. So
that's what I'm
getting about. Yeah. You got 30 seconds to get out of the room, Governor. Mike?
Governor, just a point of clarification, and I may have misunderstood you today because I thought I heard it differently previously.
Mike, can you get a mic? Michael, would you get a microphone?
Got it. Governor, this is just a point of clarification in regard to the reallocation of the governmental resources and the creation of the basic benefit. I thought I heard you say today that everyone must contribute to that basic benefit that is available to all, but perhaps I misunderstood that. Is that an indication that that would be available to all or required of all, but available based on financial need and ability to pay?
Well, I think you could do it in a couple of ways. I think the most straightforward way is to not create the administrative burden of doing a means test, but rather say there's a certain set of services that are so effective in producing health, the return on investment is so... You know, we have to we'll argue about what that is, but that should be covered. For example, you know, as you know, in traditional insurance like car insurance or homeowners insurance, you're insuring against something you don't want to happen. You don't think it's going to happen, but if it does, it has a huge economic impact on you. In our current paradigm, we insure against things we want to happen. And supposing we were to identify those things that you don't really care whether they're overutilized, because you know you want people to get screening for mammography, you know you want kids to get immunizations, well child checkups, and begin to build a basic package of those kinds of services, and those would be available to everybody. You could do it through a means testing. So there's a lot of ways to get there, but I think the point is everyone should have access to some effective level of health service. That's sort of the bottom line. Mitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to point out, William Jennings Bryan lost the presidential race.
And Archimedes was killed for his efforts, too.
I mean, you're right. John, the thing that always gets me is, I understand how they ask for a Medicaid waiver, and I understand we need a congressional action, ultimately, to get the Medicaid waiver that we shouldn't have had a need congressional action for. But I wonder how we ask for a waiver of the IRS code. I mean, that seems to me a little complicated.
I don't think that to do this, you cannot do it through administrative waivers. You'd have to have some piece of legislation that would pass that would essentially create a pilot for Oregon to essentially see what they could develop. Packwood would have given us a statutory waiver if the Reconciliation Act would be passed. I've talked to Wyden about this, and clearly you'd have to have some piece of legislation, not just an administrative waiver.
I don't even understand how technically. Let's say we had that magic wand, and now we have a new IRS code applying to businesses in Oregon. How could that actually happen? It seems to me we have a national discussion, and I can understand how we could change the national scene. I have trouble understanding how an individual state could implement a legislative waiver, even if it was offered us.
Well, a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, I think that there's a series of questions like that, and if we allow questions like that to keep us from going forward, nothing will happen. I mean, Bill Gates famously said that if you have everything you need to know for your business plan, you're too late. To get to the heart of your question, I ultimately don't think you can solve this state by state.
Yeah.
You've got companies that are owned in Oregon, operate outside of Oregon, you've got people moving in and moving out. So you need some national floor, you need some part of the benefit that is not tied to employment. I mean, that made a lot of sense when people stayed in the same job all their lives. That's not the world we live in today. We shouldn't pretend that it is. So you need some national process. But if you look at the concept that we had drafted, essentially the idea was to agree on the general parameters of what we wanted the system to do, to be given the authority to put it together, which changes the nature of the debate. We wouldn't have done the Health Services Commission priority list if we didn't have a real live waiver in play. I mean, no one would have spent the time and energy doing that. And then there's got to be a window where both the state gets to look at it, the implementation plan, and says, so someone on Medicare can say, let's compare what I've got now to what we're proposing, and the feds need to look at it to answer exactly those kinds of questions. It's my hope that if we could drive this into the Beltway next year, you'd force those questions to be dealt with at the national level, and they're not even on the radar screen. And nobody who's running for president today, or all the pretenders to the throne, is talking about these issues. And I'm desperately afraid that the political process is going to take a powder on this in 08 once again, and I just don't think we can wait. I mean, look what's happening with the auto industry right now.
Ron, Governor, I'm especially interested in what you've said about how the process works, and that's something we may not all understand here. We have to come to a clear vision on this. And the day we started, before you came here, talking about changes in the system, and they reflect a lot of what you said, and the rest of the conversation today is going to be over the same thing. But the legislators in this group have to come to the same vision on this, and that's where we have to get to. We have to get from our 3 to our 12 votes. I think we do that, we can drive something to the legislature, which can then drive, I think, where you want to go, which is a national discussion. And Oregon has to be the state to do it. I don't see other state doing it. Frankly, Massachusetts plan, as an example, is a great plan. They've done a lot to tweak the system. And what the Health Policy Commission is talking about, I think, is a good plan, too. It's much similar to that. But it doesn't drive the real issue. It doesn't drive the real question of really changing the system. And I think that's what you're trying to tell us today.
I guess the other thing, if I might, Alan, there are three democratic forces that, if you step back for just a second and think about it, states are right in the crosshairs. And if you do no more than move the financing pieces around, you're not going to get from here to there. One of them is the steady erosion of employer-sponsored coverage. That's not going to stop. And there's a reason for that. It's going to continue to erode, which is going to drop more people into the coverage gap. As the workplace-based coverage has eroded, there has been a commensurate increase in the size of the Medicaid program. That's the second trend. And Medicaid is no longer a program primarily for people on cash assistance. 25 years ago,
3/4 of the people in Medicaid were on welfare also. Today, less than about 20% are. The rest of them are workers who simply can't afford health care needs. That's the second trend. So as employers' costs drop coverage, it's going to shift the burden back on to the state. The third trend, which is by far the most frightening, there's, and for those of you who don't live inside the Medicaid world, there's a group of people called dual eligibles. They are eligible for Medicare, but they're low income, and so the state pays their premiums and their co-payments and also for services such as long-term care that are not paid for by the Medicare program. They're about 13% of the Medicaid population, and they account for about 42% of the cost. So they're the single most expensive group. As the population ages, the bottom of Medicare is going to open up and dump those people right back down on the state level. There's 49 people in Medicaid, 49 million in Medicare today. When my generation reaches 65, it's going to increase by 170%. As the population gets older, there's more disability. So that's going to come down on the state, and you, since you can't borrow from our kids' future, are going to dump more people back into this coverage gap, and those employers that still offer health care coverage are going to pick up the tab. There's a great chart that the Oregon Hospital Association has that's over the last 5 years that says private sector premiums going up almost on a mirror image of public Medicare, Medicaid dropping. So unless you deal with these big global issues, you're just nibbling around the edges. And someone's got to somehow call that question. Rick?
In being involved with all these sort of meetings, it strikes me that the Archimedes movement and the proposal that you're talking about probably carries the highest risk. It is the most bold and innovative of the discussions, or it's the most bold and different than the discussions we're having at other places. And that's with risk comes a potential for failure. And I think the question that I see is, to what degree are we as a state willing to take risk as opposed to what seems to be a somewhat less risky incremental sort of movement like Massachusetts did?
Well, that's a good question. I think it depends on how you define risk. I think in this day and age, you have to weigh the risk of action with the risk of inaction. And I believe that the demographic trends are so stark that you cannot ignore them. So let me give you an analogy. We're in a raft together. We're in the same raft. Employers, employees, seniors, kids, we're all in this raft. We're going down the river. There's a waterfall up there. We know this country cannot borrow $65 trillion from someone. We've got an aging population and a shrinking workforce. So here we go. Now, one, there is risk, right, in actually talking to each other. Someone could fall out of the raft. But the inaction, the picture of inaction, is we're all holding on to our stakeholder paddles, and we're working diligently to keep our end of the raft upstream, deriving some perverse sense of satisfaction or security from the idea that people on the other end are going to go over first. I think the risk of not doing anything and not taking these issues on so far outweighs the risk of failure. And I would just, I had a conversation actually was with Mr. McMullen the other day. We had lunch, and I said, you know, I had the same one with some of the hospital folks. Any one of you can stop anything from getting through the legislature. So can the AFL-CIO. I mean, we're real good at stopping things, right? So let's suppose lightning struck and we got the waivers. Let's suppose that we actually got a plan and you didn't like it. It still has to go through the Oregon legislature. It's got to be passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed by the governor. I think the risk is pretty de minimis. And someone has got to create a forum where we look the enemy in the eye and realize that we can't get out of this unless we take some really bold steps and do it quickly.
Bruce. Governor, talking about bold steps, sort of started with the cost piece of all of this and then talked a lot about the financing, eligibility, benefits, and the last kind of piece of that is how we deliver all that care to assure we have a good cost, we get what we want, we have a good cost, we get at the principles of providing health care. And it seems to actually be the one thing of all of that that we have probably the most control over in a lot of ways here within the state. How do we get there in terms of moving that way that we deliver care to get at sort of the rest of the principles?
Well, I think there are a couple of elements. I mean, clearly, a lot of the dysfunction in the system is driven by very misaligned financial incentives. I don't think there are bad actors in the system. I think we've got some incentives. The system does exactly what we want it to. No one competes for mental health. Doesn't pay. Everybody's got a cardiac center because that really pays. I mean, so the financial incentives need to be realigned, at least in a part of the system, at least in the public finance part, that says, what do we want the system to produce for us? We want healthy workers, we want, you know, what are those values? And we've got to create the financial, realign the financial incentives. Conversations that I've had with the insurance industry, with hospitals, with physicians, there's pretty much uniform agreement on that. So, I mean, we have the intellectual capital in the state to figure out, under an ideal set of circumstances, what would that look like? You know, then you got to talk about how you take the trapped equity that's in the current system and move it over, but you start by creating a space to have that conversation. So, you know, you could do that without the feds, but I think we need to remember that Medicare policy and financing is not something we have any control over. And so there's big pieces of this that you can't actually implement unless you can get control of those levers.
Other questions? Governor, thank you very much.
I'm sorry,
Frank, I missed you.
You made an excellent case for change and focusing on the cost side of the equation is something that I think is missed in a lot of the discussion. What, in your mind, would be the best model, delivery model, with a fee-for-service managed care? What would be your recommendation in terms of a model, delivery model?
You know, I think, Senator, that in any delivery model, whether it's a fee-for-service or a capitated model, you have to have, first of all, you have to have the financial incentives. I mean, you have to realign the financial incentives, I think, in any model. I think there is a lot to recommend capitation. There's a lot of problems with it, but it does create a different set of incentives than fee-for-service. Now, fee-for-service that's based on best practice standards, where essentially you're paying people really well to do things the right way and for things that we want to happen, I think is sort of in between. I think that the more important question that sort of has to come before that is sort of what is the benefit? What is it that we're delivering? If a capitated model or a fee-for-service model, for example, that undervalues mental health services and overvalues cardiac services, let me pick on those two, but you're going to continue to see that problem. So part of this has to do with teasing it apart and asking ourselves, I'll give you one example that really has, I think, hopefully raises this issue of avoided cost in the system and really doesn't really matter what kind of delivery system you have, and I'll just close with this. I had an experience myself with the healthcare system this last fall. My mother passed away, and she was 88. Actually, I had this very conversation with a group of senior citizens yesterday down in Eugene, and she didn't want to die in an acute care hospital bed. And there's very few people that want to die in that venue. That's why the senior lobbies have supported advanced directives and durable powers of attorney. So she had a lot of muscle pain, and we took her to her physician, and they'd done some lab tests, and one of them was this very high erythroid sedimentation rate, which is an indicator of inflammation and part of the differential with a tumor. And the workup to decide whether this 88-year-old woman had a tumor was very invasive, involved all sorts of invasive procedures. She didn't want it done. So the doctor said, we'll just send you home and check your lab book for a couple weeks. And I said, why do you want to do that? And there's this sort of stunned silence, and I said, you know, if you keep checking the blood work on an 88-year-old woman, you're going to continue to find abnormalities. And if you decide you're not going to run them all down, why do it? So she went home, and the quality of her life improved just palpably, because she and my father had been living around the laboratory, waiting for the blood test, waiting for the next lab test. What does that mean in terms of changing the medications? And all of a sudden, they let go of this part of their lives they couldn't control, which was that they were getting older. And they began to focus on what they could control, which is this robust 65-year-old marriage they had. And she died at home in October. We were all there with her. I mean, it was very sad, but it was also very beautiful in the sense that that's exactly where she wanted to be. And the point of the story is that Medicare would have paid for all those lab tests, no question asked. And of course, lab, imaging, and pharmaceuticals are huge cost drivers in the system. They would have paid for a hospital visit and an ambulance to take her there for renal failure, for three or four other things, including the congestive failure, which is her final diagnosis, no questions asked. It won't really pay very much for a primary care physician or a nurse to spend an hour with an aging patient explaining the difference between care and cure, and how to navigate this bewildering array of things we can do to you but not necessarily for you, and it won't pay $18 an hour to actually keep you in your own home. So I mean, I think part of it is stepping back and asking ourselves, in the case of the Medicaid population, what are the real needs of an aging population? Now, regardless of the delivery system that you had, whether it was a fee-for-service delivery system, when you pass a certain point, you move from a medical model to more of a social and caring model. And we don't fund options for that. So, I mean, just in the case of end-of-life issues, which is a huge driver in chronic care issues, if you just gave elderly people some options, I think it would save huge costs and would also dramatically increase quality of life. And I think those are the kinds of conversations it seems that you can engage in here in Oregon that I can't even imagine having that kind of conversation in Washington, D.C.
I think you have to be sure to also, in all of this affordability talk, keep track of the liability concerns of the doctors as well, because I think a lot of the reasons that they offer all those tests are liability concerns.
They've done some lab tests, and one of them was this very high erythroid sedimentation rate, which is an indicator of inflammation and part of the differential with a tumor. And the workup to decide whether this 88-year-old woman had a tumor was very invasive, involved all sorts of invasive procedures. She didn't want it done. So the doctor said, we'll just send you home and check your lab book for a couple weeks. And I said, why do you want to do that? And there's this sort of stunned silence. And I said, you know, if you keep checking the blood work on an 88-year-old woman, you're going to continue to find abnormalities. And if you decide you're not going to run them all down, why do it? So she went home, and the quality of her life improved just palpably, because she and my father had been living around the laboratory, waiting for the blood test, waiting for the next lab test. What does that mean in terms of changing the medications? And all of a sudden, they let go of this part of their lives they couldn't control, which was that they were getting older. And they began to focus on what they could control, which was this robust 65-year-old marriage they had. And she died at home in October. We were all there with her. I mean, it was very sad, but it was also very beautiful in the sense that that's exactly where she wanted to be. Now, my point of the story is that Medicare would have paid for all those lab tests, no question asked. And, of course, lab, imaging, and pharmaceuticals are huge cost drivers in the system. They would have paid for a hospital visit and an ambulance to take her there for renal failure, for three or four other things, including the congestive failure, which is her final diagnosis, no questions asked. It won't really pay very much for a primary care physician or a nurse to spend an hour with an aging patient explaining the difference between care and cure, and how to navigate this bewildering array of things we can do to you but not necessarily for you, and it won't pay $18 an hour to actually keep you in your own home. So, I mean, I think part of it is stepping back and asking ourselves, in the case of the Medicaid population, what are the real needs of an aging population? Now, regardless of the delivery system that you had, whether it was a fee-for-service delivery system, when you pass a certain point, you move from a medical model to more of a social and caring model. And we don't fund options for that. So, I mean, just in the case of end-of-life issues, which is a huge driver in chronic care issues, if you just gave elderly people some options, I think it would save huge costs and would also dramatically increase quality of life. And I think those are the kinds of conversations it seems that you can engage in here in Oregon that I can't even imagine having that kind of conversation in Washington, D.C.
I think you have to be sure to also, in all of this affordability talk, keep track of the liability concerns of the doctors as well, because I think a lot of the reasons that they offer all those tests are liability concerns.
Yeah, I don't think you can significantly create a system that deals with the elements I put on the table without some changes in the medical legal system. But I think you can't get from here to there, because it's got to be a part of it.
Huge waste of money.
Other questions? I want to thank you again.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time. Before we start the second Equity Commission day, let's take a little break, and I'll have you back here in 15 minutes. Senate Access and Affordability Commission.
What happens when you have the wrong guy chairing the meeting?
Yeah,
Harry.
Can't think. And we'll start with Dr. McClellan. John, before you start, I want to recognize a couple of things. First, I want to thank the Oregon Dental Association and Dr. Herringer for letting us use your facility, and thank you for lunch.
Pleasure.
And I used some fluoridated water again. And I gagged it down. I feel the sarcoma's forming, but we'll go on, okay?
Doctor.
The other thing I want to mention is Megan Sweeney. Megan, I know you're leaving to take a promotion, and you're going to Texas, and we're going to miss you. I think this is your last meeting. When are you actually leaving?
Tuesday.
This is your last meeting. Well, thank you very much for taking part in this process, and we wish you all the best in Texas.
Yeah.
Okay. We can start then?
Sure. So this is a presentation that is pretty short, hopefully, and hopefully painless for you at least. This is requested by Senator Bates and Rick Percoving, because I think there's some interest in vouchers, and they wanted me to sort of review some of the basics around these. So I'm going to review the Emanuel Fuchs proposal. This is something that they most recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. They also had sort of a follow-up in Health Affairs. And if you're interested in this, in sort of the full paper, I think Rick might have a couple of copies, and I'd be happy to email it to you. Then I'll talk about some advantages of the voucher approach. I sent this proposal to a few people, and they said I needed a slide on disadvantages, so I'll put that in there as well. And then briefly how this could be adopted for Oregon, what that might look like, and then a few other details here. So in the Emanuel Fuchs proposal, their idea is that every American under 65 receives a voucher, and you can use this voucher to get basic health services from a qualified health insurance plan. The voucher is risk adjusted, and plans can't turn it down. They can't deny enrollment or renewal. Once you have the voucher, you have a free choice of health plan, so you could use this the voucher to buy your coverage from Regents or Kaiser or Providence or whoever is offering the plan that suits your needs the best. You also have freedom to purchase additional services, so some people or their employers might decide that the basic plan is too thin and they might want to buy additional services. That might be something that looks like Medigap, or it might be a wider choice of hospitals or specialists. And then their proposal here, this is sort of a national proposal, in their idea that this would replace Medicaid and then eventually phase out Medicare. So Medicare would exist to begin with, but then everybody would have the vouchers, including people currently on Medicare. And Oregon might look a little different here, sort of depending on how it looks at, like, what it would look like at the state level. So this is sort of the basics of the plan. The package, the way that they envision it, is that it's sufficiently comprehensive to provide most Americans with most of their care most of the time, not something that's real thin or just sort of a safety net here. So they want the following: hospital, physician, preventive services, mental health, tiered pharmaceutical benefits, and then modest deductibles or copayments. And maintain sort of generally the current delivery system or health plan structure. So this is sort of the health plans are kind of the intermediary between the patient and the provider. So there's some advantages from the voucher system, at least I think from the health economist's point of view. First of all, it's, you know, once you do this, you've got universal coverage. That part is taken care of once everybody has a voucher. It ends mean-based coverage, and there's a lot of sort of concerns about means-based coverage that we spend a lot of time trying to determine eligibility. That if you end this, that you reduce administrative burden. And I think there's also sort of a sense that in the words of the authors, that if you have something that's means-based, it's always an invitation to evasion or sort of trying to make yourself look poorer than you might otherwise be. And once you sort of get rid of that and you say everybody's got the voucher, then you don't have these means-based issues floating around. It also solves the crowd-out problem.
That's right. It also solves the crowd-out problem, so a problem with the sort of eligibility based on income is that once you offer that, there's some incentive for people who have private coverage to try to pick up Medicaid coverage. And this is sort of a bigger problem as you think about what it means to expand Medicaid coverage from, say, 100% of federal poverty line to 200 or 300%. There's some concern about whether that would provide an incentive for people who are currently paying for their own coverage to try and get public coverage. And this has been shown to be a real problem with Medicaid and SHIP, with SCHIP, with, you know, national estimates being something like 25 to 50% of some of the people who are covered by those programs who might have actually been able to cover themselves through private coverage. So the crowd-out problem is one that economists worry about, and if you, you know, once you sort of do this voucher thing, then that no longer is an issue. Some other advantages are that you know, the way that this is structured, it guarantees a basic benefit package without exposing the government piggy bank to every new intervention, device, or drug. And the way that it works right now with some of the public programs is we sort of agree to cover, but we cover sort of a certain number of people, but don't talk about really sort of where the constraints are. And this is the classic OHP prioritized line argument here. But again, this is sort of trying to cover everybody with a certain amount of coverage, but sort of limiting the coverage that's available. Hopefully the idea would be that because we're only talking about basic benefits and they're sort of standardized, that you're going to get sufficient pressure to be cost effective and to really sort of get the most that you can out of that dollar, since everybody's sort of getting covered for the same thing, paying for the same thing, and all the health plans are sort of lining up trying to offer the best coverage for this, that there's going to be some potential for good competition and good economic efficiency that would come out of this. Another advantage is that in a system like this, it's easier to understand what the public dollars pay for. That once we sort of know what our basic package is and everybody has that voucher, you can see and look at it, you can sort of make decisions about whether you think that's an adequate public package. You can see, you know, you can think if you're willing to sort of vote to have it increased or to have it decreased. And that's a pretty strong contrast to the current Medicaid system, where it's hard for most people who have commercial insurance to really understand what Medicaid coverage is. In some ways, it's sort of broad-based and sort of generous, and others, there are some serious access problems, and it's hard to sort of know whether Medicaid coverage is good or bad or what it really means, as opposed to something where everybody gets the coverage and everybody's on the same page, and you can sort of think about whether that is adequate. Some more advantages here is that this reduces the insurance burden on employers. You know, I think we've heard from both the small business and large businesses that they're really concerned about what this means. I think sort of as an economist taking the big picture look, one of the great things that American business has been really good at, I may have said this before, is innovation and taking risks. And I think one of the big concerns about the health insurance issue and healthcare cost issue is the cost is one, but also that this is something that tends to make employers sort of more risk averse. It really places a high risk on them, and that's not something that we want sort of to make to sort of generally trying to help our companies be more competitive. So I think that there's some advantages there to removing some of that burden from employers. It may also reduce job lock associated with employer-based insurance. So job lock is the phenomenon that people stay at a job that they otherwise would leave because they fear that if they leave, they would lose their coverage. And there's some efficiency losses with that. There's a strong role for competition and consumer choice. I think everybody's interested in sort of getting the consumer involved here. And if you have everybody trying to pick the best plan and they have free choice of plan, there's a good role for that. And then there's some promise here, if you're covering everybody through sort of one program, of improving the delivery system. And I think that's, you know, something that we've talked about a lot, but not sort of thought about how that might fit into the sort of the coverage reimbursement decisions that we're making. If you think about right now, we have sort of Medicaid plus employer-sponsored insurance plus individual insurance, and it's, you know, it's hard to sort of make changes in care that we're in general agreement about what might be better. But if we had sort of one program and one standardized set of benefits, then we could say some things like, well, it's okay to cover group coverage for visits by diabetics, or it's okay to change the copayment structure on drugs that we know are cost-effective. And to have sort of one standardized plan there might be some ways to sort of improve the delivery of care. And then also, you know, this sort of reduces the churning or loss of continuity of care that might happen when people lose coverage or go from Medicaid to ESI to individual or something else like that. So some disadvantages. I don't have a slide here, but I think there's three important disadvantages here. One is implementation. As Rick pointed out, something like this is a sort of a much larger departure from the current system than something like what Massachusetts has done, which is sort of take what they've got and try and extend that to improve coverage. And I think that does carry a risk. Another is financing, and I think you know that that. In theory, at least, that sort of the total cost of healthcare for the voucher type system should be sort of close to something that is like what Massachusetts has done and what the Health Policy Commission is talking about. But the streams of funding are going to be different because in something like Massachusetts' plan, you're extending some public financing to cover people who are currently not insured. In the voucher plan, you're extending a voucher for everyone. Presumably, the cost to somebody who's currently covered, if they were having an employer cover their insurance, the voucher would pick up some of that, and their employer would cover the rest of it. So the total cost wouldn't change, but you are going to be sort of funneling more of that through the public sector than the private sector, and that is a different departure than what we have right now.
Sort of with payroll tax, would that be?
I think that sort of how you fund it, sort of something I'll put off for later, but that might be one option. And they suggest something different in their paper. Let me get to questions after this. Let me sort of run through this, and we'll get to the financing issues at a later point. And then I think the third sort of, so I think the first two are implementation and financing, and the third is just sort of a devil's in the details issue, that this is sort of a big change. We're having a voucher that is going to cover a basic set of services, and that requires a lot of work to figure out what those services are going to be. So that's sort of a review of the Fuchs vision. So we could think about what this might look like for Oregon, because the voucher could look like, the basic plan could look like a few different things. And you might think about sort of a very thin voucher, which would just cover preventive and catastrophic care. One that's a little bit thicker that might be sort of like OHP prioritized line, and then sort of the Fuchs Emanuel, I think it would be sort of more generous than all of those. So you could imagine what this might look like. So let's say we had a bare bones, preventive care only, catastrophic care. Right now, people who are uninsured under the vouchers, they would get a basic plan, so they would get some access to preventive care, and it would take care of catastrophic care, so it would sort of reduce some of the issues around bankruptcy and uncompensated care that we're currently concerned with. OHP Medicaid, the voucher might be sort of the basic plan, and then OHP to fill in where necessary. I think, you know, the specialized care or specialized services that OHP offers, you've got to think about how that fits in with something that is very bare bones, and I think there are a lot of question marks there about, you know, what's match and what's not match. For the privately insured, I think we would expect that the voucher would be sort of the basic plan that would take care of everybody across the state in the same way, but that most individuals and families would probably try and buy up from there. And then for Medicare, we have no change. For something that's a little bit more generous, something that would be sort of like the OHP prioritized line, for the uninsured, they get coverage that's sort of equivalent to what we have right now for OHP or Medicaid. For Medicaid, it would be the same. I think that you could get some changes here that would be beneficial. You might get improved costs for shopping since you're having everybody get the voucher and sort of look and see where the best plan is. And then I think you'd also probably get some removal of Medicaid access barriers since there's a little bit of a stigma, or I guess stigma is a good enough word, people being on Medicaid having difficulty getting access to care. If everybody's getting the same plan, the same coverage, then there shouldn't be those barriers. For the privately insured, I think probably you still have some people buying additional coverage, but probably less than under the bare bones plan. And then again, under Medicare, under at least the sort of the Fuchs manual way of looking at it, no change. So a few details. I think that, well, there's a lot of details here, but this is just a list. Of course, there's the issue of how comprehensive the voucher is. I think a lot of questions about what buy-up might look like. So could you use your voucher to get your basic plan from Regents and then your buy-up more generous plan from Kaiser? What sort of, co-payments and specialized care are covered in the buy-up? How does OHP and Medicaid fit into a voucher? Can we get some match on some of the vouchers, or do the vouchers cover everything that OHP fits into? And if not, then how does Medicaid fit into the voucher system? And then I think, you know, you could ask if you think that this is a too big a departure from what we have right now, you could consider something. I think this is sort of probably less optimal than Emanuel and Fuchs would like, but you can consider a scenario where individuals were allowed to opt out of the voucher plan and receive a tax credit for a fraction of the voucher value, assuming that they could show coverage. And this means that people who had employer coverage that they liked that didn't want to have anything to do with the voucher plan would sort of maintain the coverage that they have right now. So this is it in a very quick nutshell, but I think, you know, the idea here is just to familiarize everybody with the voucher plan and get everybody up to speed. And that's sort of all I have to say on it, and then I think we can sort of open the floor for questions or discussions, unless you want to start off from there.
I would like to have a chance to, for people to ask you questions. John, thanks. You went through it awfully fast. Thank you.
Sorry.
We got time today. We're looking at this point, the commission is looking at not just, gosh, ain't it awful, we're looking at what are some of the possible solutions to this. I often think of John Kitzhoffer's talk as one that should, it really points out the problems of the plan, goes right up to the solution and says it's time for that pressure build to produce a solution. And sometimes I think he's pointing right at me in this commission when he says those things, and I think he probably is. And so this morning we talked about what the Health Policy Commission is offering as their potential solution. This is another potential solution. And I want to have a chance to talk these over carefully with the commission before anybody rushes off with any preconceived notions. There are words here that worry some people. The word voucher worries people. The key to this program, as far as I'm concerned, though, is the thought and the concept of pooling a large sum of money in the state in order to produce a better health care system. We did some very rough modeling of how much we're putting in the state into health care, exclusive of Medicare, and what would that mean if we could put it into one pool and spread that money over in a reasonable fashion through some other system that we're using now? It indicates to us in a very rough modeling, enough money is going to the system right now that we could buy a complete health care benefit package, including mental health, dental, drug, and vision for everyone in Oregon. There's that much money in the system. But the way it's being laid out is really, really difficult to get it to the areas it needs to go to. One of the advantages of a pooled system is you start getting some oversight. You maintain your present system so that the providers, when you talk about providers, I'm talking about insurance companies, fully capitated health plans, have an opportunity to compete. I'm a big believer that in a very rough way, the government's pretty good about being efficient and raising revenue. I sometimes have concerns about how we spend that revenue. I mean, a combination of a public-private partnership maybe give us the best of both worlds, with the market working with whatever market forces we could bring to bear through HSAs or people competing for the business from individuals will lead us into a more efficient place. So having said that, I'd like to open up to questions from everybody here about this particular model that John's been kind enough to show us very quickly. Mary Beth.
So you said you started from initial modeling?
Very, very broad.
But how much do we have to spend, I guess, is the question.
You have the microphone.
So the question is, how much do we have to spend? I think that we can't really move forward on any proposal, and we've been talking about this for a few meetings now. How much is that dollar figure?
Well, I would tell you first, it's not ours to spend, okay? The state puts money in, and employers and employees put money in. Bruce, you remember what the number was? We sat down and did two models. One was cost, one was revenue. My memory was 17 per biennium.
That's a 20 question.
Well, we were looking at what it might cost for the non-Medicare side of the population, which roughly, if you figure at a, no,
a monthly $350 per member per month figure, which coming at it from a variety of places is probably a really reasonable amount for a non-Medicare population. That's 25 billion a biennium, 12.5 million a year. And that would be the cost to cover at $350 a person benefit. So you had a voucher or something that was worth $350, and that would be to cover all of the non-Medicare individuals in the state, those currently uncovered, those covered by Medicaid, and those covered by employer or their own personal buying of coverage.
And I don't want everyone writing that number down and coming back to you and say this is very, very broad numbers, and we are having each check. We may still be wrong with these numbers.
Well, I'm sorry, Nick. But I just keep wondering, you know, we must know what we spent already. So if we don't know what we spent in 2002 on health care services,
we know what the state spent. We don't know what was totally spent in the state,
including the private sector. So if we took just the public money, how much is that?
You mean just Medicaid?
The Medicaid budget, roughly off the top of my head, is $1 billion in general fund, a biennium, $1.2 billion.
A little over $2 billion total.
Yeah, and that also though includes some of the long term care expenditure. And then there's other public dollars that are
includes the match, please.
No, that's just the state fund. You figure that there's another, for every dollar we get an average of $1.50 from the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Understand that's a specialized population with specialized needs, higher than normal costs, and that we are doing cost shift in that population too, which would, both of those would, you know, if you fully funded it, would drive it higher.
And I'm assuming that does not include the money that the state uses to subsidize FEOP.
FEOP program is pretty small. I think numbers there are about
$30 million budget this past biennium. So, I mean it.
When you're talking about multi-billions, it's not that big a program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No. But it is money within the pie.
Yes. Who is first to hand up here? Mitch and Megan?
Yeah.
$40 million a year, Mary Beth.
What? John, I've got two questions. And the first relates to the term voucher, which Senator Bates pointed out raises hackles. I mean, it seemed to me when I read their article, they're really talking about vouchers in a metaphorical way. I mean, I don't think we're talking about sending out bunches of pieces of paper to have folks walk around and try and get somebody to take that piece of paper. And basically, we're talking about putting names in computers and making, saying you can buy this much health insurance because your name is on a computer, and it's basically making access to private health insurance available. But it really does have to get to the question, and I mean that's the basis of how you pay for it, because you really need to be transferring private money into public funds, and it sounds like the only rational way to do this is with a payroll tax. Is that? I mean, that's the way every other country in the world's ever done it.
Do you have two questions, or do you want to?
Well, it's somewhat. Okay, so it's, I mean, the first the first question was that vouchers. We are really mean.
Yeah, I think
kind
I mean
of metaphorical so. Voucher, not a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Watch out for the labor.
I think that the financing is a great question. I think that that's sort of something that needs to be discussed at a certain point for any of these policies. What the Fuchs and Emanuel paper, what they envision is a value-added tax that sort of serves as a rheostat for how much we should spend as a nation on healthcare. What percentage of our GDP should be spent on healthcare? With the idea that with that tax, and with the, everybody's knowledge of the basic plan, that there's sort of a much better way of making social decisions about whether that tax should be raised or lowered, or how generous it is. I mean, think generally, you know, with so that's sort of their impression of it. You know, payroll tax, other types of taxes. I think that that's something that I actually can't provide a lot of input about right now.
It is tax supportive.
It is tax supportive.
The whole system.
Mitch. Yeah, I'm going to tell you that from this point of view, it's we have to talk about the system first. Is it effective? Does it get us where we want to get to? Is it more efficient? Does it save us money? You know, essentially, right now, businesses are paying a huge amount out for health care. That, in essence, is a tax.
I'm not opposed to payroll tax. Either.
Well, I know you're not, but others might be.
But I don't see how you cannot. I mean, when you're talking about giving everybody in the country a basic health care system, you have to understand that we're talking about creating a basic tax-supported healthcare system.
Well, there are other ways of doing it, and we're going to discuss those later. Right now, I want to discuss this system and see if it's worthwhile.
But for Dr. McConnell, at some point, I think it would be important for us to discuss the fact that no matter what system we use, it has to be funded somehow, and it all comes out of our pockets eventually, either through our employers or through our own tax system and so on. And at some point, it would be nice to try to understand how long it would take the system to move to equilibrium as if we changed it and said, wage tax on wages or something. Eventually the system is going to reach equilibrium again, where some taxes will go down, some will go up. It'll all be coming out of our pockets again. It's just a question of how it's distributed across parties. So I think that part of the reason we get stuck on this all the time is we don't recognize the two realities. One is that we pay it all now, one way or another, through either hidden or real taxes, and two is that whatever method we use, we will again achieve an equilibrium at some point in the hopefully not too distant future that redistributes that. And what we're really talking about is taking the leap and saying that we're willing to move in a direction of trying something different. So, I mean, the voucher sounds very intriguing. Again, there's a significant degree of unease in the room because it's a bigger risk.
So, do you have two questions, or do you want to
ask? The first question was that vouchers, we are really mean.
Yeah, I think that means
a metaphorical voucher, not a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Watch out for the
I think that the financing is a great question. I think that that's sort of something that needs to be discussed at a certain point for any of these policies. What the Fuchs and Emanuel paper, what they envision is a value-added tax that sort of serves as a rheostat for how much we should spend as a nation on healthcare. What percentage of our GDP should be spent on healthcare? With the idea that with that tax and with everybody's knowledge of the basic plan, that there's sort of a much better way of making social decisions about whether that tax should be raised or lowered, or how generous it is. I mean, think generally, you know, with so that's sort of their impression of it. You know, payroll tax, other types of taxes. I think that that's something that I actually can't provide a lot of input about right now.
It is tax supportive.
It is tax supportive.
Mitch. I'm going to tell you that from this point of view, it's we have to talk about this system first. Is it effective? Does it get us where we want to get to? Is it more efficient? Does it save us money?
Essentially, right now, businesses are paying a huge amount out for health care. That, in essence, is a tax.
I'm not opposed to a payroll tax.
Well, I know you're not, but others might be. Okay.
But I don't see how you cannot. I mean, when you're talking about giving everybody in the country a basic health care system, you have to understand that we're talking about creating a basic tax-supported health care system.
Well, there are other ways of doing it, and we're going to discuss those later. Right now, I want to discuss this system and see if it's worthwhile.
But for Dr. McConnell, at some point, I think it would be important for us to discuss the fact that no matter what system we use, it has to be funded somehow, and it all comes out of our pockets eventually, either through our employers or through our own tax system and so on. And at some point, it would be nice to try to understand how long it would take the system to move to equilibrium as if we changed it and said it's a wage tax on wages or something. Eventually the system is going to reach equilibrium again, where some taxes will go down, some will go up. It'll all be coming out of our pockets again. It's just a question of how it's distributed across parties. So I think that part of the reason we get stuck on this all the time is we don't recognize the two realities. One is that we pay it all now, one way or another, through either hidden or real taxes. And two is that whatever method we use, we will again achieve an equilibrium at some point in a hopefully not too distant future that redistributes that. And what we're really talking about is taking the leap and saying that we're willing to move in a direction of trying something different. So, I mean, the voucher sounds very intriguing. Again, there's a significant degree of unease in the room because it's a bigger risk. It's a bigger step than what most people talk about. So from an economic standpoint, I think at some point we have to have that discussion around, you know, how long is it going to take for the system to come back around.
And the other part, and I agree, Rick, the other part of a system you're discussing is if it does just come back around, we haven't gotten there. I mean, we want a system that is more efficient, that's portable, that has open access to everybody. Does this kind of a system offer any of those options? I think it offers some of them very obviously. Does it make it more efficient? So it holds the health care costs down? Don't know. That's another discussion. Megan.
So I'm trying to figure out how a user would use the system. So the voucher seems to me it doesn't have a dollar figure. It has a set of it gives you a set of mandated benefits. Is that correct?
I think the idea is that you they talk and they sort of their vouchers are risk adjusted, but I think that the basic idea would be that that say everybody in this room would have access to getting a similar plan from a variety of health plans, and so that that the dollar amount would probably be irrelevant, that you wouldn't get a better plan than I would. It'd all be the same plan, but we would all sort of make choices about, you know, what networks are available or what sort of the benefits look like. There'd be some subtle differences between those two, and that you would make a choice, and that sort of the idea is that the whatever dollars you're paying for, that everybody gets the same package. Is that
okay? Yeah. So I'm just seeing how a sick person and how a healthy person would experience the plan differently. It doesn't sound like they would. So then, let's say they choose Regents to provide their coverage. Then does Regents say to the state, okay, is it a capitated system? I guess I'm saying, and do they just take on the risk of?
Well, that's a good question. I think, off the top of my head, I don't know exactly how some of those things would work. I mean, I think that the basic idea that would be that it would be capitated, that health plans would get a certain amount of money for each individual, and that they
based on their status.
Based on their status, and that, you know, I think the risk adjustment is hard, and you have to probably do a combination of some risk adjustment and some standardization of plans, because you don't want, plans to offer the, the free tickets to the movie and the, the no coverage and whatever to sort of attract the very healthy people who don't use any health services, but they get their $6,000 and then avoid the sick people or something like that. So you want to avoid sort of the bad competition of adverse selection and encourage the good competition of these are sort of basic benefits and we're trying to provide, you know, evidence-based, cost-effective benefits that are similar across people.
Maybe I can help this question, too, a little bit. There's the judgment for the pools that they might be insuring by these different providers. It is a pretty common practice. We do it, the state does it, for instance, with the fully capitated health plans. Each pool across the state is different. And what they get on a capitation basis for who they've got enrolled in their plans is different because of that. There's always discussion and whatnot about what that capitation looks like. But there's experience doing that, and it's fairly reasonably accurate, I think, to do that. So that when you look at your pool, you are getting a capitation that reflects the risk in that pool. And whether it be age, sex, illness, chronic illnesses, and that sort of thing. And that can all be put into it. And so I think of this when you think of risk adjustment. I don't think of it by the individual. One voucher would be worth more than another, but that the pool would be risk adjusted by the larger pool. It says we're in this pool this amount per capitation because they have a higher risk of individuals. Maybe they have more HIV positive people, or they have more chronic illness, or an older population, or more pediatric cases in one side or the other. So you have that kind of ability in a large pool to do so. What I like about this is it helps you maintain your present delivery system in many ways. Insurers, IPAs, managed care plans will still be able to work and function, but the individual will have access to those plans now. And that's one of the big advantages. It allows systems to be set up that might actually be more economical. Representative Richardson was in Alaska 2 weeks ago. And looked at a system which he told me about, which is very intriguing. And it basically is a pool set up to deal with a certain population. Maybe you can give us some details on that. Could you just give for a moment tell us about what you saw up there?
Okay, I, along with several people in this room, had the opportunity to go to Anchorage to the South Central Foundation, which is a fully owned medical facility and system for 50 tribes of the Alaskan natives. They have about 44,000 people that they care for. And over the last 8 or 10 years, they have transferred into a system and implemented a system of intensive medical care, where you have a team that would have maybe 1,200 patients that they would be responsible for, and the team would be a physician, a case management assistant, or a manager, a physician's assistant, and in many instances a behavioral assistant. So they would bring in mental health and physical health together. They tried to have the doctor work at the top of his license and not merely do whatever doctors do, but delegate as much as he could. And they would they see about 15 patients a day instead of 30 to 40. And what they found over time is that by putting in more time with these Native Alaskans and their families, that they increase their health and they increase their contact and their trust with their medical providing team, and so they've cut the cost or the frequency of emergency room visits by about 50%. They've actually reduced the frequency of visits into their offices by a substantial amount, because they, when they do come in, they do more than just treat the symptoms that they're in for. They also have them do an A1C or maybe a blood test or check cholesterol or whatever, and try and help them understand certain things that could be done for lifestyle changes and giving counseling and advice and do follow-up. They don't just give them a prescription and hope they take the medicine. They'll follow up to see that they got taken. And that, and by doing this, they find that their patients require less care because they're healthier, and they have greater trust that when they need care, they can get care. And they're hoping they'll get down to 10 to 12 visits a day instead of even 15. And they're spending a lot more time with them. But, of course, they have a different incentive, and the physicians are on a salary basis. They're not getting paid based on the number of procedures they do and the number of people they see during the day. They're getting paid based on their outcomes. And so as long as they are working toward having healthier patients, then they get greater financial as well as other rewards. And so it's a socialistic system where there's no cost shift. All the money is paid for by the government. The patients come in without having to pay any kind of copay, but what was interesting about it was that instead of thinking because it's free there would be an increase in utilization, they found by the way that they're doing this that there's been a decrease in utilization. And so it was a very interesting model to see. And Director Goldberg was also there as well as some others, so he might be able to add more.
Bruce?
Well, that was great. Great summary. I guess the only thing I'd add kind of to sort of segue it back to Governor Kitzhaber's presentation is I think what they really did up there is they really defined what they valued in sort of healthcare and in delivering healthcare, and then really set up a delivery system and are trying to sort of put their resources where their priorities are and really looked at setting up a different kind of manner of delivering healthcare based on what they valued as a community, and it was a very interesting and an impressive model in terms of how a group did that.
Rick, just that model for some part was supported by a Pursuing Perfection grant from IHI. And not saying that there's anything wrong with that. I think that this is the model that has been pushed by IHI, which is a very primary care-centered, team-centered, open-access-centered, prevention-centered model, as opposed to our model here, which is more specialty-centered, more invasive-centered, not nearly as preventative as their model has been. And I think it's a wonderful success to see how that's worked out.
The question that brought to my mind is, would a system that you've described give patients options to get into that kind of system if they wanted to, and that kind might or might not grow? It fit that population group real well. I'm not sure it fit every population group. But they had cultural things that drove it, and
certainly brings up the idea on vouchers as to what provisions are there for cost containment, because we're talking about access and a way to provide greater access, but unless we deal with cost containment somehow, then we're just going to price ourselves out of it. Even if you could start it, you couldn't continue it.
Mark Lurby.
So what's your voucher proposal? Are you saying that the same amount of money is supposed to buy the same package for every individual when they go to the insurance company, the same amount of money is supposed to buy the same coverage for each individual, right?
Yeah, I think probably with some differences in plans and sort of what they offer and some slight differences, but I think basic coverage would be the same.
Well, how do you think you're going to get the insurance companies to buy into this without getting some sort of equal distribution of risk of the patients? I mean, if you're going to give the same amount of money per patient, that's not fair. If you're going to give the same amount of money per patient, why wouldn't one insurance company, take only the young, healthy people for the same amount of money? You're going to have to get some sort of a pool that equally...
Well, I think you can do two things. I mean, one is there's no denying patients, so the insurance has to take whoever they're offered. The second is you can risk adjust, and the third is you can standardize some benefits.
So they could charge the person more than, I mean, you're going to have to, you would have to equally pool and distribute the patients per insurance company if you're going to expect the private insurance company to buy into it, right?
Let me walk you back through this again. And I'll use the fully capitated health plans we use in the Oregon health plans as an example. You don't try to risk adjust for each individual patient. You let whoever comes into your plan. You don't want the insurers in a position that, one, they end up with a lot of high-risk people and they go broke. You don't want the multiple cherry-picking and running off the profits. So what you do is you look at their population on an annual basis and you risk-adjust their pool.
But it is done on an individual basis. I'm just adding up across individuals.
Yes, but we have a means of doing that.
Yeah, you're right. No, there's technology for it.
And there's a tech for it. It's pretty accurate. Sure. And we've done it. So we know we can risk-adjust a pool and set their capitation rate based on what the risk in that pool is.
So you're going to have to look at what that in the individuals that go to a particular insurance company and adjust per insurance company depending on the patients that they take.
Yes.
So you're not looking at the entire pool together, because looking at the entire pool together, you still may not get the same distribution from company to company.
The way I understand the Fuchs model, that risk adjustment takes place at the individual patient level. You know, the voucher that applies to each patient, to each individual, is risk adjusted based on that patient's medical experience or health. And that way, a sicker person yields a higher capitation payment to a health plan. So that's where that risk adjustment takes place.
Yes, so it's not the same.
It can happen either place, because Medicare right now and Medicare Advantage plans pays a flat per capita rate, and then at the end of the year, adds risk adjustment payments or reduces basic. Yes, in our plan it does.
And the basic rate comes in age and sex and geography.
And then disease.
Later.
Yeah, risk adjustment.
Let Rick finish here. Rick, wait. Rick, you finish. Mitch, you finish.
No, what he's saying is the original payment comes in at an age-adjusted rate, and then disease
gets risk
adjustment is done on the other end, not at the front end, so that each patient who comes in, I mean, you can do it all sorts of ways, but the point is that, you know, you want to create a plan that doesn't encourage patients, you know, plans to cherry pick or avoid disease, patients with disease.
Or the other direction, putting an insurer at risk because they picked up too much.
Right.
Mike, is that correct?
Absolutely.
As long as the risk adjustment is taking place, that's the key thing. There are many models to do it, just as everyone's indicating.
Okay. You're Ike.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding this. Would it be fair to say that at a minimum, what needs to be or an essential component of this is the development or the development of a essential benefits package to begin with?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what you're paying for.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You have to have a benefit package that's agreed upon. And you have to have, and as a commission, we have to agree on a system that deals with that benefit package. You then have to decide how you want to finance it. You got to be absolutely certain you've got cost controls in place. If you've got cost controls in place, you haven't done anything. All you've done is move the chairs around the deck again.
Right.
Okay, you've got to have, in the end, we have to have some method of controlling costs. This might give us some opportunities for that. That's what this discussion is about, and frankly, what the next commission meeting will be about those issues. We're not talking about, gosh, it's awful. We're talking about what are some of our options. Sorry, Ike again.
Michael, would you say it's fair to say that with an efficient risk adjustment plan in place, that this would be market-driven and contribute to the success of the voucher program then? For example, someone wanting to buy up or...
It would be a market-driven system, but I think equally important to this mechanism is the cost containment and bringing the efficiencies and... making sure that we're delivering optimal care. I mean, unless we do those things on the other side of the equation, we may have solved the everybody under the tent issue, but we've not solved how are we going to contain the costs and hold that line.
Steve.
Question I think for Dr. McConnell. This is not so much about the cost of care, but about the competition mechanism. So an article just came out across Kaiser's distribution, I think yesterday, about the majority of individual policy seekers being turned down or couldn't afford the policy. Is there a mechanism in the Fuchs plan to ensure that individual shoppers are able to afford the plans? How do we know that the plans will react to normal market competition?
Well, I think that's sort of one thing you have to get right, is your basic plan and the amount that the voucher covers have to sort of make sense to the plans, otherwise plans will just leave the state and not cover anybody. But assuming that you've got that part solved, then everybody gets a voucher,
It all buys the same plan. Nobody can be denied, and you can't be denied for renewal. So everybody gets it, and they can go to the plan, and the plans can't turn them down. If they don't choose a plan, they're automatically enrolled in the plan. So the shopping, it encourages shopping among different plans, but there's not the issue of you can't afford it because you already have the voucher.
So the shopping is only on the basis of secondary sorts of features to the plan?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, you're sort of, you know, does this plan have my position or do they have other amenities? And I think that's sort of where, yes, there's some details here, and I think maybe that's where it gets interesting. And some plans provide more efficient care or things that are better than others and sort of advertise that and track patients that way. I think the idea is that you cover a basic set of services and then you see where the plans want to innovate beyond that.
I think you might see some really strong innovation here. Some plans might offer a robust HSA, as what you get from the plan. They would offer certain hospitals or certain physicians or other providers in the plan. You'd see those kind of things starting to happen. I think if there was a market there which was robust enough money in it, that they'd want those patients. And they can start competing for them and offering things that other plans didn't. Okay, and that, you know, co-pays might be different. Hate to use it as a parallel because it's got some problems, but Medicare Part D offers multiple plans of a basic benefit you can pick from a number of plans. There's a lot of problems with Medicare Part D, okay? But it gives you at least some idea of what's going on there in that kind of a market-driven plan. Frank.
John Newman, as I recall, has published in some document he's provided us where you had estimated the total health care cost in the region of $17 billion, as I recall.
No, that wasn't me. I think what I did, in fact, was look at the cost of hospital uncompensated care. Is that? I don't recall another.
Okay, maybe it didn't come to you.
Yeah, maybe that's not from me.
We're modeling that right now, Frank. We want to get some solid numbers before we actually dive into the revenue piece. We really want to know where we stand on that. We did a very rough look at it, and I mean very rough, and tried to calculate roughly what's being spent in Oregon outside of Medicare and what a system of pooling would buy for us. It looked like it was in the ballpark of a wash. But what it means in that is you're talking about everybody insured for a change. Getting rid of the cost shift, which we would obviously get rid of. But those numbers are very rough, and I don't want to be held to them or anybody in the room held to them. We'll have more numbers by our next meeting, which is going to be late in October. Carl, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You said something earlier today that really intrigued me. You're self-insured, who says they have a large pool. How many employees do you have?
65,000 in that plan.
We have 65,000 employees. You essentially have a pooled plan. You've kept your health care costs down to 6 or 7%, which is still increasing annually. It's still too much, but it's much better than everybody else has done. My question to you is, what did you do? You have 3 minutes.
Well, we have several different plans, and people can choose between that. We have two HSAs on the deductibles, so those that aren't using the plan very much can get into the HSAs. We contribute also match dollar for dollar for the first $500 put in there, so we encourage people to use that. And then we have two other PPO plans that are varying degrees of benefit, so it's more of a several plans that you can choose from and that fits your needs.
You feel that the HSA models have helped hold down costs because consumers make wiser choices or different choices?
I think they make choices. And when it's their money, they're thinking a little bit more about what they need to do. Of course, we have a rider there that we offer, and we pay 100% for the preventative care right off the bat. So and we have added a prescription, so preventative drugs are covered in that also, that you don't have to take out of the deductible. So it encourages people to go to the doctor and look at what's preventative and hopefully catch some things before they get out of hand.
And overall, that 6% growth you've had each year, how far back does that go, do you think? We're not going to cross-examine you next time. Ask you to bring a chart.
That's probably 3 years.
I would offer that you essentially are obviously operating as a pooled resource for your employees as far as healthcare is concerned. And you're talking about having already implemented over the last 3 or 4 years some things we'd like to do statewide. And if the state of Oregon held its healthcare costs down to 6 or 7% a year for the last 3 years, we'd have probably half the people in the nation coming here to ask us how we did it.
Sure, can we ask what the average cost has been for employee?
Well, it's different for each plan. I mean, I don't really have an average cost. I couldn't tell you that right now.
Okay. Thank you, Carl. Yeah. Rick.
We're essentially in the same position, and our I can't quote the increases, but they haven't been what increases in premiums have been across other health plans. I think the issue, or one of the things that I would ask, you know, someone smarter than me to comment on is how when you have a captive population that is 100% insured, how are you able to better control costs than a situation where you have, and where you have people who can contribute to their health care costs? How that can be translated, if it can be translated, to a population here in Oregon where 2/3 or 3/4 of the uninsured are below 300% of federal poverty level, or 200% of federal poverty level, or 60%. And can that sort of, you know, can you translate the methods for saving in that population to the ones that are uninsured? And my answer, our experience with the standard population, those people who were insured below 100% of federal poverty level, when we added $6 per member per month as a premium, we lost 40,000 people, and many of them were the sickest. People with chronic diseases like diabetes and schizophrenia and so on, who for one reason or another couldn't bring up $6 a month to pay the premium. And so, you know, I think the model that's being used by Fred Meyer, I think has got a lot to learn from. We can learn from it, but does it in fact translate to a population that it doesn't have health coverage right now? And I think we have to be careful and not translate it directly.
Look, I'd agree with that. There's a certain population, and I'm not sure where that number's at, that really has a difficult time making good health care decisions. And they have difficulty making decisions throughout their life for lots of reasons, and that's one of the major reasons there, mental health and drug and alcohol problems, the rest of it. On the other hand, I believe there is a large part of that population that can make good decisions if given an opportunity to. You started the day for us talking about a very tragic death of a 37-year-old man. And I believe if he'd had an open access to health care, the likelihood of him not having died at age 37 would have been much lower. And his problem was access, I would guess. I don't know the exact case, obviously. But those of us who are treating physicians know those cases over and over again. The other issue in this, and Dr. Webby and I talked about this earlier, physicians in this state and practitioners of the state are more and more moving away from taking care of Medicare and Medicaid patients in many areas, taking only commercial patients. And that's going to lead to another shift in difficulty for us. This kind of system would kind of blanch that out. I believe your system, Rick, already does. That's all washed out. So whatever patient you see is not as material as it is now. You know, we go back to the same question. The patient calls my office, and I don't want the first thing they're asked is, what's your insurance? I want the first question to be, what's wrong? How can we help you? That's a big shift. Mary Beth?
Thank you. So I guess I have a couple of questions, and I don't know that it quite relates to this, but this is actually a dramatic shift from what we have been talking about and what I actually thought we had some agreement around in terms of... And I
population, those people who were insured below 100% of federal poverty level, when we added $6 per member per month as a premium, we lost 40,000 people, and many of them were the sickest, people with chronic diseases like diabetes and schizophrenia and so on, who for one reason or another couldn't bring up $6 a month to pay the premium. And so, you know, I think the model that's being used by Fred Meyer, I think has got a lot to learn from. We can learn from it, but does it in fact translate to a population that doesn't have health coverage right now? And I think we have to be careful and not translate it directly.
Would I agree with that? There's a certain population, and I'm not sure where that number's at, that really has a difficult time making good health care decisions. And they have difficulty making decisions throughout their life for lots of reasons, and that's one of the major reasons. They have mental health and drug and alcohol problems, the rest of it. On the other hand, I believe there is a large part of the population that can make good decisions if given an opportunity to. You started the day for us talking about a very tragic death of a 37-year-old man. And I believe if he had an open access to health care, the likelihood of him not having died at age 37 would have been much lower. And his problem was access, I would guess. I don't know the exact case, obviously. But those of us who are treating physicians know those cases over and over again. The other issue in this, and Dr. Webby and I talked about this earlier, physicians in the state and practitioners in the state are more and more moving away from taking care of Medicare and Medicaid patients in many areas, taking only commercial patients. And that's going to lead to another shift in difficulty for us. This kind of system would kind of blanch that out. I believe your system, Rick, already does. That's all washed out. So whatever patient you see is not as material as it is now. We go back to the same question. The patient calls my office, and I don't want the first thing they're asked is, what's your insurance? I want the first question to be, what's wrong? How can we help you? And that's a big shift. Mary Beth?
Thank you. So I guess I have a couple of questions, and I don't know that it quite relates to this, but this is actually a dramatic shift from what we have been talking about and what I actually thought we had some agreement around in terms of, and I guess how does universality, I mean, everyone gets the voucher, right? But now we go back, when you said Medicare, that is actually one of the first things that kind of popped into my mind with the whole choice of plans. And I don't want to say yay or nay with this right now, but I'm just curious about how fundamentally that would work, because, you know, if everyone is in one pool with the essential benefit package, that seems to me slightly different than this, even though it's also similar, but it's not the public good component, I guess, as much, or maybe I'm just not understanding it. But also the other question is, has the competitive competition in the healthcare market really worked? I don't think we'd be sitting here if the answer to that were yes.
I'll try to answer some of your questions first.
Medicare Advantage.
This is a discussion.
Right.
This is a discussion. I want to get very clear. What we talked about with the Health Policy Commission this morning was a discussion. I'm not planning to run down to Salem this afternoon and start drafting legislation. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is a discussion. This commission has to have a chance to talk about these really tough issues. We said somewhere along the line we're going to talk about tough issues. Today we start that discussion. It's easy to sit here for 4 or 5 months and tell us what's wrong with the system, how bad it is for employers, how bad it is for employees, how many people are left out of the system. All things we've talked about for 4 or 5 months and have a good understanding now of what's wrong with the system. Now we're getting down some tough stuff. Now is when you really have to leave your hat outside this building and talk about different possibilities. But they're just possibilities, okay? So understand that.
I appreciate it.
If you think competition hasn't worked in the system, I would agree with you, because I don't think there really is competition in the system. It's a monopoly, okay? When a patient comes to me and wants and has a gallbladder attack going on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, they don't start asking me,
you've got three hospitals I can go to in your area and 23 surgeons. I like to do a real quick check on all 23 surgeons, what they charge and what their rates of mortality and morbidity are and what the hospitals look like, what their infection rates are, and the rest of it. They say to me, Doc, pick me one. I'm in misery here. You got to fix me before I die. That is not a competitive system. That's not the way I buy a car. Well, I have bought cars that way. and I was thinking, sorry I did. But, I mean, that's not a competitive system. The system is competitive when, I believe, when various insurers are competing for patients, those patients have choices among those insurers made at a reasonable time, looking at the benefits being offered to them, what they can buy up, what they can buy down, do we have an HSA, what's in it for me, what's their provider base, what hospitals does it mean I go to. Those are decisions people can make in a reasonable fashion. And I think you start bringing some competition in at that point. Do I know that for sure? No. But Fred Meyer has three competing plans, essentially. And for whatever reason, maybe it's the population they're dealing with, but we're seeing this escalation of healthcare costs, not just in the very elderly, not just in the very poor. We're seeing it across the board, okay? And that escalation has to be brought under control, and Fred Meyer, apparently, to a degree, has brought that under control. To a degree, okay?
Not under control, but it's...
They've reduced the train, okay? It's not going on a track quite as fast. So that's my answers for you. I mean, they're not perfect, but that's the best I can give you. Mitch.
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate this issue of risk-adjusting premiums. And I think competition has worked, for example, in the Medicare Advantage plan because the rates are properly risk-adjusted in areas where there are competing programs. In Multnomah County, there are problems with that risk adjustment because of the geographic adjusters screw things up and we get hurt in Oregon. But if everybody really brings a premium with them that will cover on average across populations their cost of services, then competition, the nature of competition changes. The nature is not to get somebody who will bring more money and use less service. The nature is to match the program with the dollars that come. And for example, that really allows some programs to say, we really only want to take sick people. And if we take sick people, we'll arrange better care for them, we'll do chronic care, but we need to know we're getting enough money to cover the cost of the sick people. And that's where cost savings can come about. Or we just want to deal with healthy young people. There's no problem with having a program to deal with healthy young people as long as they're not bringing more money with them, as long as it's not a cherry-picking thing. They bring less money, but that's what that program wants to work with. You can create competition in the nature of the program as long as the program managers have a belief that on a population basis, they're getting fairly paid for the risk that they're facing, and they're willing to take risk, although insurance companies, as Michael knows, are extraordinarily risk-averse. But basically, as long as they have a sense that there's a fair shot. The Oregon Health Plan is now risk-adjusted, right?
It has
been for 3 years.
Yeah.
And I think it might be useful for you just to comment on that, because it really does even things out.
Yeah, I mean, risk adjustment, I think it'd just be stating what everybody's said previously, that you have to have some method of risk adjustment to assure appropriate access. We didn't, when the Oregon Health Plan started, and realized that there were some plans that were very adversely affected. And so we instituted risk adjustment and actually phased it in over the last several years, first risk adjusting a couple of populations and creating some risk corridors that were put in, and as we sort of moved towards complete risk adjustment. And it's, you know, initially there was a lot of concern, and I think now it's been generally very accepted, and it's worked very well.
Mitch, I'm going to apologize. I didn't make myself clear earlier. When I was talking about fully capitated health plans, I was talking about the Oregon Health Plan. We've got about 75-80% of the population now in those plans. Those are all risk-adjusted plans. There was a lot of give and take at first, but we got there. So that experience is out there.
All this discussion on risk adjusted plans is after the fact. We have essentially Oregon serving as an insurance company, and they're talking about assuring that those that provide the services get fair compensation. If we're talking about universal access and there's going to be an independent or private sector model to it, then that's called underwriting. And so underwriters determine based on a pool or on a population what they're going to charge, and then when you have multiple underwriters with different companies, you have competition. And so if we want to keep prices down, then we need to help assure that we give a system or a skeleton that will allow fair competition to take place among companies, and not merely saying we guarantee that you're not going to be hurt because we can adjust for risk after the fact based on what your losses are. Because then that's a payment factor, not a bid factor in pre-enterprise. If we want to keep premiums down, we consider having, we don't give a guaranteed issue. We say that if there's been care or treatment within 6 months of the application, then for that cause or that disease, it could be covered by, is it OMEP? You know, we have a state-funded program for people that can't get normal coverage, and it's paid for, contributed to by all the insurance companies. And so if we have those that are at great risk paid for, that coverage is paid for by all the carriers, then they can actually underwrite based on not having to worry about getting three quads and, you know, and another problem that could skew everything. So it allowed their underwriting to be based on a more known quantity of people, because they wouldn't have to cover all of the great risks and being worried that maybe they're going to have higher than the other insurance companies. So I'm just saying that let's not get too enamored with risk adjustment if we're talking about universal care and we want a private sector model involved, because that's underwriting.
So just to make sure I understand this carefully, because I know you used to actually do this for a while. You would look at risk, not risk adjustment, but underwriting the plans in a way that the pool underwrite them, basically. And that would allow the plans then go ahead and compete.
Right.
Okay. In very simple terms.
It can be set up with pools. I mean, you can set up any number of parameters. You can say we're going to do this regionally, and we're going to invite bids from X number of companies. We don't have a million companies providing health care coverage in Oregon anyway. Most of them have pulled out in the last 10 years. And so we know who the players are, and we could actually develop a program that Dr. Goldberg has mentioned as a possibility, looking various options, where you have, you know, say three carriers in a region, and we say here's the population base and here's what the mix are, and let them bid on what they're willing to provide with a set plan of benefits. And we never, at least I've not heard the full discussion or any discussion on what the underlying basic policy is going to look like, but until we actually lay something out, this is all theoretical, because you can't do a fiscal unless you know what the benefits are, and there has to be an agreement. And if you're looking at Oregon Health Plan, the last number I looked, it was $317 per person, and I've heard $350, that's per person in the OHP. But if I'm an employer, my benefits aren't as good as the Oregon Health Plan. So if the Massachusetts plan, you say, let them go, because they can do better in the OHP. So are we really going to lower benefits on the Oregon Health Plan so that we can have universal access and then let people buy higher benefits? What are the benefits going to look like? But sooner or later, our discussion has to go to what is the underlying basic plan going to be, and then we can talk about how we're going to fund it.
I agree. You have to have the benefit, talk about the system and the financing of it, and we understand that, so I appreciate that.
But you also raise a very good point. What would happen to the high-risk pool currently? Would they be wrapped into these other things? Would they stay as their own separate pool as they are currently?
I think you could potentially go either way. Okay, but
raise a very good point. What would happen to the high risk pool currently? Would they be wrapped into these other things? Would they stay as their own separate pool as they are currently?
I think you could potentially go either way. Okay, but probably if you actually set up a high, this is theoretical. Thank you. This is a theoretical discussion. a theoretical discussion. I would expect if you actually wrap this pool and put this pool together, you wouldn't need that anymore.
Right.
Okay, that would resolve that issue.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
At an increased cost.
Well, and
not necessarily.
And
those costs are there already.
But aren't the premiums paid for by the individual?
In the OMIP?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Subsidized.
And the program
was subsidized by insurers. My employers.
Yeah, 110%.
All come right back. Hi, Carl. How you doing?
How
you doing, Ike?
$1.42 per member.
I mean, this discussion shows part of the issues with our system, which is because we have multiple providers, multiple insurers, multiple choices, we end up with all these discussions around risk adjustment. And we've got this problem, you know, where companies are rated based on their employees' experience as opposed to community rating. And, you know, we could really, there's another place where we might say, let's move to state rating. Where we do a state rating and look at options around how we, you know, get rid of some of these perverse incentives that for health plans or providers or whatever to avoid sick patients. My only point with that is we've had a whole long discussion about how do you risk adjust or how do you do this, that, and the other, and it's all based on our current market system.
I just wanted to clarify a few points. In regard to groups being rated on their experience, that is not the case in the small group market and the C-high pool, 2 to 25. It is essentially a modified community rating, and there are very limited factors, geography, group size, and age are the only factors that go into the equation of the C-high pool and how that is rated in the marketplace. And it is a guaranteed issue. You can't restrict the offering of a health plan to one of the C-high groups or refuse to write a benefit to them. Secondly, I wanted to go back to the notion that Mary Beth Healy raised in regard to competition in healthcare. And I appreciate your remarks, Senator Bates, on the fact that when it comes to catastrophic care, when it comes to emergency care, there is no competition. Patients don't ask, what's the price, what's the outcomes, who's the best quality? It's, get me the help I need, and that is correct, and that's the way it should be. But in the next iteration of this healthcare system that we're talking about, if we don't have complete transparency of cost and outcomes at all levels of the healthcare delivery system, we won't achieve the cost savings that we're after. And, you know, you asked the question, Mary Beth, you know, does competition in healthcare work? Well, at the delivery level, it really hasn't been tried with a few.
We don't have all the other information.
We don't have that information. It's not readily available, except for some very limited things, some cosmetic surgery that we see in the paper, and we've seen prices drift down dramatically there, but that's a unique situation. So we have to have that competition at the health plan level. We have to have it at the delivery system level if we really want to achieve the cost savings that we're after and change how we deliver and look at care.
Although I have been accused of talking out of both sides of my mouth sometimes. You know, this morning as I was listening to the discussion, as we've gone through the day, we're getting back to originally when we sat down was, can we bring in universal coverage at some level to the people in Oregon? We don't seem to yet have resolved the issue, the other side of that issue. So I don't think you can bring universal care unless you bring universal financial participation. that it's not to say that you do not bring in safeguards in certain situations and things. But when Dr. Kitzhoffer was in, I've heard his talk before, we talked, and I was in one specific area, everybody kind of nods their heads in agreement, and that is, when people get to a certain age, maybe we're not allocating resources properly anymore, that we need to switch from medical to social a little bit more and see that their final days or years or months, whatever you want to talk about, are pleasant rather than an awful lot of procedures that have very limited value. So what we're saying is that society is saying that after a certain point on delivery, maybe more isn't better, maybe less is. Let's take that to the other end. I've spoken before that I think in the small business community, you have to protect the startups. We're a small business state. We have to do that. But I hope this doesn't, on this other side, sound too Darwinian. But after a company's been in business for 5 or 6 years, or 4 or 5, whatever that subsidy period of time is, if they still can't afford to participate in the system, then again, as a society, you know, maybe that particular entity is too marginal and shouldn't survive. Maybe those employees ought to go someplace else for an employer that does. I say this starting out as a small business a number of years ago, we're going to 1,200 employees. So I understand all the issues, I think, in running a business of different sizes and everything. But I think at some point we're going to have to cross this bridge and make that determination, because I understand there's a lot of money in the system and everything. As an organization, we also not only did not have an increase in medical last year, it was actually a little decrease. I about fell off my chair when I first heard also. And really prevented us to going to a self-insured model based on the quotes that came in. But I'm not foolish enough to think that that's going to continue. It's that cycle you go through, along with some adjustments we made a couple of years back that are finally starting to have some benefit, which incidentally had to do with short-term disability, not the medical plan. But at any rate, but had a huge influence on where we're going medically. But all I'm trying to, I guess, say is that at some point, I guess, we need to, you know, make the decision. Are we going to have a player pay model? And it's really the same discussion I think I heard 12, 15 years ago when the Oregon Health Plan came around, player pay. Now, whether that responsibility goes to the individual or goes to the employer, large or small, depends on the system that you set up. But at some basis, we're all going to end up having to pay a little bit more. Because once you pool in a small group market, which I'm all for, if you talk with most insurance companies behind closed doors, they will tell you that there's a difference in their administrative costs dealing with small groups the way they are now as opposed to large groups. And I can tell you how skinny that administrative cost will get in large groups when they're really being competitive. You either want to hold on to a group or make inroads to another group. So anytime you talk about somebody's costs going down, it means somebody else's costs are going up. I think that that's a good thing, because what we also started talking about here was an even playing field. And I think we ought to give the small group, small employer groups in this instead a better playing field than they have right now. Thank you.
More questions? First, I want to thank everybody who sent in information about my last meeting about what their thoughts were about the commission and where we're going. I did read all that, and the discussion today was actually generated by most of those suggestions. The sense I got was we need to move forward, we need to look at some plans, we need to have a discussion about those plans. That's what we've done today. We will continue this in our next meeting. I'm not going to ask for and think of a consensus at this point. I'd like to have you look at what we've talked about today and have a chance to reflect on it when you go home, think about it, and bring those reflections to our next meeting again. And we've had two rather different approaches to this problem presented to us today. One, incremental, very, very similar to the Massachusetts plan, a little stronger than the Massachusetts plan. It isn't completely fleshed out yet, but we'll be hearing more about the next meeting. The other plan we've talked about is a voucher plan. There may be others we'll be discussing in the next meeting also. Think about what we've talked about today, more the principles than the actual plans, and we're ready to discuss that again on the 23rd, because we're rapidly moving forward at that time. And the 23rd is the date for the next meeting, right?
27th.
I'm sorry, 27th. October 27th. We're going to push it out a bit. Yes.
Senator, so you, thank you. So you mentioned the principles aspect, and it might be helpful, and tell me if this is not appropriate, but, you know, I think that we have had a number of conversations over the last many months, and it does seem that there are some principles that we are all in agreement on, and it might make sense that we codify that somehow so that we can move forward. The issue, Steve, that you just raised around a pay-or-play or employer responsibility, however we define that, Senator Morse actually asked that exact question 4 or 5 meetings ago. And so I think that it might be very helpful to us because we've got a good sense of, really, and there's probably more plans out there that we could continue to look at, right? It's ad infinitum. We could look at Kentucky. We could, you know, there's tons of stuff that's going on out there. But again, for a uniquely Oregon system, I think that we've agreed it needs to be universal. It needs to be all of these things, a system that is fair in financing, etc. And I really would be excited and hope that the next meeting really does start taking a look at what is the package of benefits, what can we buy, and we and I know you've got some of the numbers now, but I don't know how far we can move forward until we have that information.
Well, Mary Beth, thank you for a wonderful segue. We need time to get those numbers together. Okay, just give me right down the middle. The next section, we're going to talk specifically about various benefit plans, whether it's the pre-op type plans, whether it's basic health plans we see in insurers, whether it's a new health commission plan for Medicaid. We want to have some numbers for you at that point. We need time to crunch those numbers.
October 27th?
Is it? 27th, not the
13th. Yes, we had to move it out. We can't get the numbers together that fast. So we come back in, we'll have much more concrete information for you about what the benefit packages look like, what they cost, how much is going in the system now, and we'll probably be able to show you some possible revenue sources for that and what those revenue sources look like. Okay?
Excellent.
So we'll be getting down to brass tacks next time. Other questions?
Brass tacks.
Serious brass tacks. Okay? Any other questions?
You know where the meeting is going to be?
We're debating that. We may well be in Salem next time. We have to have a venue where we can get information quickly and have a way of displaying it. And we may have to go to Salem. We're looking at possible places in Portland, but we haven't found one yet.
Kaiser won't let us back? Is that the deal?
Well, it's something about your attitudes over there, Mary Beth. They just knocked us out. Kaiser was wonderful to us and had a great place to visit and meet at, but we need something where we can present things a little differently for us, and we may well have to go to the Capitol to do that. We'll let you know what it's going to be. Okay? Any other questions? Once again, thank you for taking a Friday and coming in. I know this has just kind of burned your brain out, but thank you for your participation. We look forward to seeing you in about 5 weeks. Thank you. Right. Okay?
Excellent.
So we'll be getting down to brass tacks next time. Other questions?
Brass tacks.
Serious brass tacks. Okay? Any other questions?
You know where the meeting is going to be?
We're debating that. We may well be in Salem next time. We have to have a venue where we can get information quickly and have a way of displaying it. And we may have to go to Salem. We're looking at possible places in Portland. We haven't found one yet.
11. Kaiser won't let us back. Is that the deal?
Well, it's something about your attitudes over there, Mary Beth. They just knocked us out. Kaiser was wonderful to us and had a great place to visit and meet at, but we need something where we can present things a little differently for us. We may well have to go to the Capitol to do that. We'll let you know what it's going to be. Okay? Any other questions? Once again, thank you for taking a Friday and coming in. I know this has just kind of burned your brain out, but thank you for your participation. We'll look forward to seeing you in about 5 weeks. Thank you. Exactly.